using us as a subcommittee, since we don't have a quorum on 2731, and just for taking the testimony of the two representatives seated before me, then we will do the medical marijuana bill. It has a simple amendment to adopt and out. Do the conflict amendments on a couple bills, and then we'll go to 555. So after this testimony, we'll move fairly quickly. Representative Williams.
You need to open the public view.
Oh,
Kiki.
I don't know.
Maybe we won't do this.
We'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2731.
A bill that's now in trouble.
I'd just like to say that once a staff member, Mr. Chairman, always a staff member. I used to whisper that to you.
Yeah, I know.
It's harder with the microphone.
You're going to get a homework assignment here.
Mr. Chairman, I'm pleased to be here, and I appreciate you taking us out of order today. Representative Walker and I are going to be having you back on the floor shortly at the House of the meeting this afternoon, and we have committee as well. But House Bill 2731 was worked over considerably in the House Judiciary Committee, and you have the Ambrose version of the bill in front of you. There have been a fair number of amendments that were proposed and made initially, but really, Mr. Chairman, the issue gets to an issue that's important to many court reporters that do their work here in the state of Oregon, and primarily I'll let other people focus on the issues that get raised, but it really is an issue about making sure that all parties who are present to a deposition or proceeding reported by a court reporter are treated fairly and equally, and that we continue to preserve the integrity of the product, the deposition, or other proceedings recorded in this procedure. I just want to say, Mr. Chairman, that I've worked with the parties on the House side to try to negotiate what I thought and what I still believe is a reasonable version of the bill that answers most people's concerns. I know there are a few other concerns with the bill, but I think House Bill 2731 and Gross, as it appears before you, is appropriate and answers the general questions that have been raised, and I think does a good job in balancing this issue out. I will say, Mr. Chairman, that there is some question that was raised that I want to comment on. In Section 2 of the bill, Subsection 2, it states, any person employed or otherwise engaged to record a reported deposition must provide equal services to all parties to the action for which the deposition is taken. There have been some questions about whether or not that applies to an entire action. In other words, that every deposition taken in an action have to be charged at the same price within the context of a particular suit. And the answer, Mr. Chairman, in my reading of this part of the statute, and certainly the intention on the House side, is that they would not have to be charged the same, only that in a particular deposition, the parties would need to be treated equally. In other words, you and I, Mr. Chairman, could be in a lawsuit, you representing one side, me the other. We would arrange for depositions, and we would go to Bend. That court reporter in Bend would have to charge you and I the same amount and provide you and I access to this transcript in an equal fashion. But when you were to come before them to take a deposition, you would maybe use a different court reporter, and they would charge you and I a different price, but again, you and I would pay the same amount. And it does not mean that the same price has to be charged for every deposition throughout an entire action. Simply, both parties or all parties to a deposition would pay equally for each individual deposition. And there would be no favoritism given to one side or the other, either based on an express or an implied contract or a relationship between the lawyer and the court reporter, or between that lawyer's client and the court reporter. And that's really the primary issue that the bill intends to reach. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I'll end my comments. I'd be happy to answer any questions. If there aren't any questions for me, the committee, Representative Walker is the primary sponsor of the bill, and I'm sure can certainly answer your questions if you have any.
With your one point, do you feel there's any need for an amendment to clarify that, or do you think the legislative history is sufficient?
Well, Mr. Chairman, as you and I both know, I'm always suspect about what we say here making any difference to a court at any time in the future. But I really don't think that it needs an amendment. I think where it says all parties to the action for which the deposition, and it refers to the deposition, I think that's clear enough on its face that I believe the court, if forced to ever interpret this language, would come down on my side of the interpretation. So I don't believe it needs an amendment.
It's always
good to see you quoted in the Carter Field. Yeah.
Well, I appreciate you. I try to get there as often as I can.
And well, I would wait too.
Yeah. Am I there this week?
I think so.
Oh, great, great. I haven't even read that.
It's the Wall Street Journal.
Question for Mr. Williams is not a little accusing. Be gone.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I did want to, Mr. Chair, could I clarify something Mr. Williams, Representative Williams, did say about the equal services? That does not acknowledge the fact that if an attorney orders a rush transcript or a court reporter is transported by plane somewhere, the court reporter is going to charge more for that transportation. So that equal thing doesn't apply to that. So you're okay with that? Well, I mean, there might be surcharges that are charged simply for travel and expedited transfers. But basically, the charges, the regular and customary charges are the same.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I have no objection to that. I mean, that's, I think, common practice. Okay. What we're talking about is if the court reporter I can't have a court reporter who works for me and gives me a break on every deposition that they record for me and then charges you the full freight. That's the situation that this bill is attempting to
do. Representative might get a bigger smile from me than the other attorney, but that's about all that we can provide extra. So that's the best that we need to get. And by the way, I'm Vicki Walker's chair representing House District 41.
Okay. Thank you.
So if I might just make a few comments about the bill. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am a court reporter in my real life, and sponsored this bill at the request of the Oregon Court Reporters Association in response to some companies and law firms that were entering into contracts with court reporters to provide services. The bill sets out who is not allowed to report civil depositions so that impartiality is maintained, because that is the essence of being a court reporter. It requires reporters who are under contract to state that upon the record, and it creates rules with regard to production and distribution of the record, which we just we've talked about in terms of cost. The bill came out of our Civil Judiciary Committee on an 8-0 and one absent vote, and we had a couple of hearings, and it was a unanimous vote out of the House. We've had a number of parties work on this, and I think it's a good piece of legislation, and I urge your support.
Thank you. Questions?
Other questions?
Thank you for your testimony.
Okay. And later you'll hear from other parties. Okay. Thank you. I have fun. Excuse?
We'll temporarily then recess the public hearing on the House Bill 2731. Open a work session on House Bill 3052. This is a medical marijuana bill. We have one small amendment, and then this is going to be moved. And
Mr. Chair, the dash A5 amendments delete the bold language at the top of page 2 of the Engross bill, which I understand the House Committee actually deleted in their action, but it never ended up getting taken out of the bill. And what it is language that would indicate that a person could serve as a designated primary caregiver for only one person. And the folks who have consensus on this bill agreed that that language should come out in that that would be the A5 amendment.
Thank you. And then the chair would move the dash A5 amendment to House Bill 3052. Discussion, objection, arrangement, so ordered. The chair then would move House Bill 3052 as amended to the full floor of 2000 recommendations. Discussion, objection, so ordered. Senator Burdick, could you carry this since you heard the testimony?
Yes.
Thank you. we will now, the chair would move to suspend the rules in order that we can reconsider House Bill 3576. Objection? Seeing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chair, the conflict of interest.
The chair now would move to reconsider the votes that we took sending House Bill 3576 before due pass. Discussion, objection, so ordered. The bill is now before us. It's House Bill 3576. And
Mr. Chair, you sent this bill out yesterday, I believe a few days ago, with conflict amendments, and there was another conflict in those amendments, and so we are here with the A5.
So we conflicted into another conflict? Great. The chair then would move the A5 amendments to Senate Bill 3536. Discussion? Objections? affirmative, the chair then would move House Bill 3576 as amended to the floor due pass. Discussion? Objection? So what? Same carrier as
Senator Brown.
Senator Brown. Good. We're surprised. The chair then would like to suspend the rules here if possible. Is it one that we've already in? All right. Then the chair would open the work session until 2135. And
Mr. Chair, the Ingress Bill 2135 is two things. One, exempt disclosure of public employees, information that would identify public employees who are actually using a pseudonym at the Department of Revenue in the collection for collection purposes. And the bill would also allow disclosure of confidential information for the purposes of the law enforcement of the mail fraud, federal mail fraud. Laws. And when the committee initially heard this bill, there was some concern expressed about the exempting from public disclosure the names of or the personal information of folks who are actually using pseudonyms in the Department of Revenue. The department has agreed to delete that section of the bill, leaving only the mail fraud provisions, and that is what the A5 amendment.
Thank you. Are there questions concerning the A5 amendment?
Could you say those again?
What we're leaving in is the mail fraud provisions, allowing the exchange of information for enforcement of those laws, but you're deleting Section 1, which would exempt from public disclosure the personal information with regard to folks who are using pseudonyms.
At the Department of Revenue.
Mm-hmm. And with C5.
Senator Carty moves the A5 amendment to House Bill 2135. Discussion. Objection. Ordered. Senator Carty moves House Bill 2135 as amended to the floor. You have. Discussion. Objection. Ordered. Carry hold. All right. Senator Courtney will carry. All right, then we'll open the work session on House Bill 3397. And 3397.
Mr. Chair, the committee heard this bill last week brought by Climate, and they were interested in making sure that the exemption from public disclosure information or records that they may obtain from businesses in some people would actually disclose the home addresses to especially districts such as Climat to geographically kind of identify areas in which their employees are living to try to focus in on or try to encourage the use of public transportation. If in fact those special districts maintain that information of the employees' home addresses, is there some concern that it would then be a public record disclosable to anybody who is interested in obtaining. So the bill actually, the original bill, would exempt from public disclosure the names and addresses of those employees. The amendment addressed the concerns of the newspaper publishers in that, for example, the zip code could be very beneficial for the newspaper publishers who might be interested in writing an article about commuting preferences or the use of public transportation. So the dash one amendments specify that what would be exempted under this bill would be the street and the number of the employee's address. The city that they are living in or the zip code would be disclosed.
I'll move the dash one amendment.
Courtney moves the dash one amendment to House Bill 3397. Discussion? Objection? Ordered.
Move 3397 to the floor review pass recommendation.
Senator Courtney moves House Bill 3397 to the floor review pass. Discussion? Objection? Ordered. Carrier, please.
Okay.
Thank you. Mr. Tarno, sir. All right. We will now go to the work session on Senate Bill 555, Steve Marsh. Here a moment ago.
Thank you.
Jeff, I don't want to keep you here. I don't know where where Steve is. Would you like? Well, Jeff, would you like to go ahead and go now? Fine. I'll have Representative Jeff Cruz forward, please. And committee, you are going to be passed out if you haven't received already the dash 14 amendments to 555. And this is the result of numerous meetings. And we're being handed out 3 pages just to show what the deletion would be in, if that's perfect. All right. What is going to happen, Jeff, on page 24 is by deleting from paragraph 3A and B, and then on the top page 25, the old print, we determined that language wasn't necessary because our earlier in the bill and in prior legislation at the local level, the local Children and Families Commissions are designated as the group in charge of planning. So by giving the county commissioners authority to appoint, it was a bit of a conflict, and we want the Children and Families Commission to have that authority. So, Jeff, if you'd identify yourself and speak.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Jeff Cruz, represented District 45. And what I want to speak to today would be specifically Section 46, which is found on, interestingly, page 46 of the Dash 14. And first, I want to thank the committee for the work they've been doing. This is obviously watching you work here, a much calmer body than we are, and that may facilitate a few things. But in a conversation a while back with Senator Bryant, we had talked about this audit section, which it had been in House Bill 2268 as being an integral part of trying to do a systems analysis. And what we intend in this is, this is not a numbers crunching audit of every facet of the system. And we have had conversations with LFO about this, about how they would go about it. And we're in the middle of that discussion when 2268 totally fell apart for reasons I won't go into. And the intent of this, Mr. Chair, committee members, is to give us an overall picture of what the system at the local level and at the state level looks like. And it's not any intent of this audit to direct funding or micromanage the way funds are spent, but to see how the various components of the system fit together, how the funding sources fit together, in a way to help us identify where the gaps are, both in personnel and funding. The other audit piece that's in this bill is also a good piece, but it is basically the way we audit ourselves now, and that is for each component of a system to analyze themselves and see how they have done. Very vital, very necessary, and also information that will help us in this more global audit that we're going to attempt to do in this. But I think as we continue to evolve the system, until we have a mechanism that's going to allow us to have a big picture look at what everybody is doing and how it all fits together, we're going to be still kind of out in the dark on a lot of this stuff. And there were two or three pieces in this whole concept we've been working on that I thought were very vital. This is certainly one of them, especially when we move into the interim and trying to do a study of the system and find out what the next evolution of this is. We need to have this kind of information. So I'm very glad that this got added to it. I just wanted to come here and put on the record that we, this is not the typical number. We aren't going to go out and do number crunching audits of schools or counties or anything. We want to find out who the players are, how they connect, how the funding connects, because we know we have problems, and until we have a kind of global view of this thing, I'm not sure we'll ever be able to come up with real solutions to identify those problems.
And I want to thank Representative Cruz and Dan, because they came up with this idea. It was in the House bill, and the version that we put in 46 is almost identical, except it selects some pilots to do the review, and that's partially to avoid too much expense that would cause a problem down the Ways and Means. So I think we can still get the same results, and naturally by conducting that type of an audit, it's going to affect all the others that are audited too. The other feature that is in the bill that was in, I think, the 12 amendments is the legislative task force. And the idea there is to continue to study the problem, see what works, what doesn't, and at the same time, make sure that what we're putting together in 555 operates the way that is intended. The coordinated system, the coordinated planning, how they intermix, especially between state agencies, local programs, that we haven't created some turf battles that would interfere with delivery of services, because our common goal and purpose is to help families and children. And I'm thankful you started the process in the House with the House bill, and we've plagiarized a few of your good ideas.
And it is time, I realize, that to move this on to another body, and the process is waning, and hopefully we're out of here by the end of the June, Mr. Chair.
I'd like to put that in the bill.
Thank you. This year.
I call Steve Marks and Pam Curtis.
Chairman, for the record, Steve Marks, Governor's Senior Policy Advisor, appreciate the opportunity to be here. I want to thank the members of this committee for the work that you put forward on 555, and Chairman, I'd like to thank you as well, and particularly for making the connection with the House members, which I think was extremely important. I know Representative Mannix and Representative Cruz made a contribution to this effort that has been, I think, vitally important for us to be able to move forward, and as well, I'm greatly appreciative of the Majority Leader's role finding a way to work with us to advance this legislation. We appreciate that. With that, Mr. Chairman, we would intend to go through a brief section by section on the bill, but we have a schematic for the conceptual proposal here that may refresh members as to how this all fits together.
Okay.
I'm going to be doing that for the record. Pam Curtis, Policy Analyst in the Governor's Office of Healthcare, Human Services, and Labor. You have a handout coming, but if I could draw your attention to what's going to be put up here on the overhead. This briefly will outline the conceptual framework behind Senate Bill 555. The idea here, if you look at the circles in the top box, those are local planning activities that happen currently under state statute or are proposed to happen under Senate Bill 555. You can see that there is an early childhood planning process. There currently is an alcohol and drug planning process, a process that happens for children's safety nets, juvenile crime prevention, mental health, and others. Those are all currently processes that happen at the local level under the direction of the Board or Boards of Commissioners. Each of those relate to some state agency or some state-appointed commission or other body, and you can see on the overhead it's color-coded. So the juvenile crime prevention plans at the local level correspond to what happens with the Juvenile Crime Prevention Advisory Committee at the state level. The alcohol and drug planning that happens at the local level corresponds to a council known as the Governor's Council on Alcohol and Drug Abuse Programs. So there are a series of planning opportunities and operations that happen at the local level. What Senate Bill 555 proposes to do is to maintain those relationships, yet at the same time drawing them together, each of those individual plans together, for a comprehensive plan that is coordinated for services to children and their families ages 0 to 18. That's represented on the overhead in the yellow box, and it's intended in Senate Bill 555 that the role of coordinating the development of that plan and facilitating those agencies and organizations coming together be assigned to the local and state commissions on children and families. And we'll refer to this as we go through. So I'll turn back to Steve and we'll start our section by section review.
Chairman, we will have a section by section document. Yeah, I don't know if we to begin, Section 1 of the bill establishes the state policy for serving children and families. It requires a balancing of needs, strengths, assets, and it directs state agencies to work in partnership with local entities. Section 2 outlines the legislative findings. Section 3 is a section that clarifies several existing definitions and creates new definitions. Subsection 3 gives responsibility to the local commissions on children and families to coordinate and lead a process for the development of a comprehensive plan. This role is exclusive to the process of creating the local coordinated comprehensive plan. It doesn't supersede any other local or state authority by statute or code. It does, however, provide the sole authority for local commissions on children and families to coordinate the planning process needed at the local level. Subsection 4 excludes state and local curriculum or instructional programs from inclusion in a local coordinated comprehensive plan. Section 4 provides authority to the State Commission on Children and Families to set guidelines for planning and coordinating service delivery. They are directed to do so in conjunction with other state agencies. Section 5 it provides for the appointment to the State Commission on Children and Families, and in this section you'll note that it adds two non-voting advisory members from the legislature, one House member, one Senate member appointed by the President and Speaker. Section 6 establishes the duties of the State Commission on Children and Families. It's in subsection 3A, it restates the role of the State Commission on Children and Families in setting guidelines for coordination of services consistent with Section 4, which is the policy. And subsection 3A, it provides the role of the State Commission on Children and Families is to also to work with the Oregon Progress Board and other agencies and to monitor progress toward meeting local coordinated comprehensive plan benchmarks and outcomes. Subsection 3H directs the State Commission on Children and Families to work with other state agencies and relevant commissions to review findings and data from local coordinated comprehensive plans and to use these findings in the design and coordination of services. And 3J, continuing, requires the State Commission on Children and Families to ensure that proven practices and policies are communicated to local commissions on children and families and on the legislature, state agencies, and the governor in order to improve the planning process, and also the commission is to include information about the extent to which local coordinated comprehensive plans are making progress in meeting their outcomes and utilizing proven practices. Subsection 4 sets up a review and approval process for local coordinated and comprehensive plans, and it ensures that any other necessary approvals are obtained before the State Commission on Children and Families approves the local coordinated comprehensive plan. Subsection 5.3, in conjunction with the Department of Human Resources, holds the State Commission on Children and Families responsible for providing technical assistance to local commissions on children and families. And subsection 5F, that specifies that any waiver allowed by the State Commission on Children and Families must be granted for the purposes of early childhood prevention, intervention, and treatment. This does not affect the ability of the state and local commissions on children and families to expend funds allocated to them that are dedicated for services to school-aged children and adolescents. Simply applies to the wavering process. Subsection 12 requires the State Commission on Children and Families to report biannually to the legislature and the governor, and this includes an update on proposals contained in the CARE Team report from the 1991 session. Moving to Section 7, this makes some technical amendments related to pilot programming. Section 8 allows the State Commission on Children and Families to set up advisory committees as necessary and requires that advisory committees include members of local commissions on children and families. Section 9 abolishes the Coordinating Council for Children and Families. Section 10 makes technical amendments consistent with Section 3, which excludes state and local curriculum for instructional programs. Section 11 is technical amendment for consistency. Section 12 deals with members of local commissions on children and families. It provides new authority for the board or board of commissioners to appoint members and limit terms as necessary. And Section 13 addresses the roles and responsibilities of local commissions on children and families. This subsection ensures that And subsection 1 ensures the local commissions on children and families work under both the direction of the Board of Commissioners and the guidelines set by the State Commission on Children and Families. It adds community mobilization for the purpose of local commissions on children and families. It also describes the duties of the local commission on children and families. And while it's not intended to provide authority for the local commissions on children and families to prioritize the services and use the funds of other state and local organizations, it does allow them to look at the effectiveness and priorities of the that they have in their local plans, and it does require that local commissions on children and families mobilize community support for non-dedicated resources, and the priorities reflected around those non-dedicated resources. I want to just address this section because I think it's clear under this subsection that the work of the local commission is under the Board of County Commissioners and under the State Commission, and we think that this is a direct conflict with Section 20, Sub 3, which has the board's authority to appoint discretionary, and if you look further, I may be just slightly ahead of myself here.
Well, and I mentioned, Steve, when you were not in the room, that on page 24,
yep.
Subsection 3, subsection A,
right.
Going on to 25, we are intended to delete that.
Right. Well, we would concur with that because we think this section 13 lays out the proper relationship between the commission, board of county commissioners, and the local commissions on children and families. Continuing, subsection 2 of section 13 gives local commission on children and families responsibility for the process of the process of creating local coordinated comprehensive plans
It specifically requires the involvement of other public and private partners. Subsection 3 outlines that the process identified in the previous subsection must result in development of a plan that coordinates program strategies and services for children 0 to 18 and their families. Subsection 4 requires the plan to address needs, strengths, and assets, including those children and families at risk and have no target associated with it. In subsection 5, it specifies that the local coordinated comprehensive plan must include connection and coordination of services, a continuum of supports for children 0 to 18 years and their families, local early childhood system of supports, a local alcohol and drug abuse prevention and treatment plan, and a local high-risk juvenile crime prevention plan. In subsection 6, it further elaborates that the local plan, that the local coordinated plan improve results, streamline the processes, contribute to the statewide system, and improve the public. And with that, I'll let Pam take on the next section.
Okay. Section 7 through 11 simply are technical amendments for the purposes of harmonizing language. Same is true with section 14 and 15 through 18. Section 19 is the evaluation section. What it does is set up a consistent evaluation framework for all of the components of this coordinated plan, all of those circles that you saw on the chart. And it directs that all of the evaluations contain the following common components. Goals that are associated with the Oregon benchmark, proven practices of effectiveness, specific populations that are targeted, indicators of progress, baseline data, fiscal accountability, shared responsibility for evaluation, and improved coordination of services. In subsection 2 of this section, the State Commission on Children and Families is directed to disclose evaluation results to anyone who requests them. Subsection 3 requires that the Progress Board review the outcomes achieved by local plans for the purposes of identifying success in meeting those targets. When we move to section 20, this establishes a statewide system of early childhood support for children 0 to 8 and their families. The first subsection directs the State Commission on Children and Families to work with the Department of Education, the Children's Trust Fund, the Department of Human Resources, and other providers of early childhood services to establish policies for a statewide system. It intends to acknowledge and affirm the critical role that many of these organizations play in providing supports to Oregon's youngest children. It directs them to work together in establishing a statewide system. And while it does not direct that any one agency control the system, it does name the State Commission on Children and Families as the point of accountability to assure that this system is jointly developed and available. Subsection 2 outlines the minimum components of this statewide early childhood system. It emphasizes, as you can see there, coordination of programs, the consolidation of administrative functions, and building on existing programs and community supports, and matching the most the families and children who have needs with the most appropriate services for those needs. Subsection 3 was referred to earlier and is intended to be deleted, so I'll skip that. Section 21 establishes a statewide Healthy Start program through the local commissions on children and families in all counties of the state. Subsection 7 of this section allows counties or groups of counties to request a waiver from the Healthy Start program requirements in order to use those funds for other early childhood programs. Gives the State Commission the authority to grant those waivers for the other programs so long as they meet the requirements of the Section 21 and the local county can demonstrate improved outcomes for young children. Section 22 allows local commissions on children and families to establish relief nurseries and outlines the minimum requirements for those relief nurseries. Section 23 allows the State Commission to set up two additional relief nurseries in the 9901 biennium, provided they are first a part of the early childhood portion of the local coordinated plan. Section 24 grants the State Commission the ability to encourage the development of family resource centers through local commissions so long as they are consistent with existing family resource center statutes, and it lists three additional key components for family resource centers. Section 25 directs the State Commission to work in conjunction with the University of Oregon's Institute on Violent and Destructive Behavior to expand First Steps Violence Prevention Program through funding that would be directed to local commissions on children and families. Sections 26 through 30, again, are technical amendments. Section 31 directs the Governor's Council on Alcohol and Drug Abuse Programs, one of the circles you saw in the earlier chart, to prepare criteria and policies for a statewide plan of services for alcohol and other drug prevention and treatment in order to guide the local planning process by local alcohol and drug councils. It also directs that those local alcohol and drug plans become a part of the local coordinated comprehensive plan. And it lists 6 criteria and policies that must be included in the statewide plan, and you can see those listed in bullets. Section 32 directs that all state agencies who provide or purchase alcohol and other drug prevention or treatment services to coordinate client data, funding, and expenditures for the purpose of increasing service capacity, monitoring resources, and coordinating outcomes across the state. In Section 33, there are legislative findings for alcohol and other drug abuse prevention and treatment services. Added to those findings in this bill are the development of a statewide alcohol and other drug abuse plan through the Governor's Council that should incorporate priorities from local alcohol and drug plans, describe the needs for services and the process for prioritizing services, and setting forth principles to guide the purchase of alcohol and other drug services. Section 34 addresses the membership and the duties of the Governor's Council on Alcohol and Drug Abuse Program. Section 1B adds 2 legislators as non-voting advisory members. 1D requires the Council to review and approve components of the local plans that have to do with alcohol and other drug abuse prevention and treatment. 1E directs the Council to ensure that citizens are involved in the planning and execution of plans at both the state and local levels. And Section 35 contains even more legislative findings related to alcohol and other drug use, predominantly that these problems pose significant costs, both social and health costs to Oregon, and significantly impact the budgets of the state and local agencies, their workloads, and the problems of the clients that are served by those agencies. Section 36 begins the high-risk juvenile crime prevention portion of the bill. Subsection 1 establishes the Juvenile Crime Prevention Advisory Committee within the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission. Subsection 2 sets the statutory membership for the JCPAC, which includes 2 legislators as non-voting advisory members. Subsection 3 describes the governor's appointment to the JCPAC. Subsections 4 through 7 deal with the terms, leadership, meeting, and staffing requirements of the JCPAC. Section 37 staggers the membership. Section 38 outlines the duties of the JCPAC. I'll let you look at them there in many bullets listed. Section 39 deals with the local side of high-risk juvenile crime prevention planning. Subsection 1 requires that each Board of Commissioners designate a lead agency to facilitate the creation of a partnership of critical partners to develop a plan. Subsection 2 defines the target population for the plan. Subsection 3 directs the Criminal Justice Commission to allocate available funds to support these local plans and to ensure that a minimum grant is available for small counties. Section 40 provides a process for waiving requirements for juvenile crime prevention planning. Subsection 1 specifically allows counties to place greater emphasis on younger children when they're granted a waiver. Subsection 2 directs that any waiver that was granted for early intervention services during the 1998 review be extended to June 30th of 2005. Subsection 3 requires the JCPAC to establish a process for granting waivers in conjunction with affected counties and requires that those waivers be consistent with the goals of Section 31, 32, 38, and 39 of the bill. And subsection 4 addresses the documentation for waivers. Subsection 5 establishes minimum criteria in the bill for waivers. And I won't read those again to you, but they're listed in bullet form. Subsection 6 directs the JCPAC to act on waiver requests within a 90-day period of time. Subsection 41 repeals Section 40 in the year 2006. Section 42 directs the JCPAC to coordinate the planning and implementation of actually several other federal grants that Oregon currently receives focused on high-risk youth or coordination services for high-risk youth, and it allows counties to receive a consolidated grant for these purposes. Section 43 repealed that section in July of 2004. Section 44 provides the necessary authority to the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission to implement the JCPAC recommendations to coordinate administrative and technical assistance functions of state agencies for juvenile crime prevention, to administer and adopt rules necessary, and to contract for juvenile crime prevention programs and services. Section 45 directs the State Commission on Children and Families, the JCPAC, and the Governor's Council on Alcohol and Drug Abuse Programs to report to the next legislative session on the implementation of this bill. The State Commission in this section is further directed to report on any additional proposals from the 1991 Children's Care Team report that ought to be implemented. Section 46 directs the legislative fiscal officer to conduct a performance audit of state and local agencies that are subject to this act, and specifically lists what the performance audit will include, and I know you had an earlier witness on this, so I won't go through this again. Section 47 creates an interim task force on children and families. Subsection 1 addresses the membership of the task force. Members would be appointed by the Speaker of the House and the President of the Senate, and the majority of the members would be local providers of services to children and families. I want to take a minute to say that while the membership listed here in this section is not complete, it should be noted that it specifically does not contain representatives from the education community. And in services such as Head Start, Oregon Free Kindergarten programs, early intervention, early childhood special ed programs, education community plays a critical and substantive role in providing supports to our young children and their families. And in addition, those two programs specifically represent the largest early childhood budget in the state. It would be our hope that the Speaker and the President will use their authority to appoint education representatives to this task force as well. Subsection 2 sets the purposes of the task force as gathering information about early childhood programs and evaluating the feasibility of a statewide coordinated early childhood program. Subsection 3 outlines the authority of the task force. Subsection 4 directs the Speaker and the President to develop a work plan and a list of subjects for the task force to study. Subsection 5 says that that work plan can only be modified by the Speaker and the President. Subsection 6 allows the legislative administrator to employ necessary persons to fulfill the duties of the task force and specifically directs that the services of permanent staff be used to the greatest extent possible. Subsection 7 allows reimbursement of legislative members. 8 directs all state agencies to furnish information and advice as necessary. 9 allows the task force to accept grants and contributions. 10 addresses quorum requirements and potential legislative actions that may result from the task force. And subsection 11 directs the task force to present its findings and recommendations to the next legislative assembly. Right, technical amendments in section 48. In section 49 regards the youth challenge program that's currently operated by the Oregon Military Department. It allows the military department to adopt reasonable policies and procedures for youth who attend the program, including drug testing policies.
The reason why this was added, it was unrelated to 555, but 555 has a great relating clause. And what's happened is this program has been running for a number of years. It's a 9-to-1 match of federal funds from the Department of Defense, and it uses an old military facility in Chief County. And it was determined that they could no longer do drug testing. They've been doing it for years, but and the AG's opinion said, no, that's, you need legislative authority to do that. So Section 49 was added because of the relating clause to enable them to continue to do drug testing, because with that group of youth, it's important they continue to do it.
Mr. Chairman, if I may, I'd also clarify that for alternative schools, they're able to drug test at the direction of the local school district.
Thank you.
With that, I'll let Steve finish up the section by section.
Sections 50 through 51 are really the budgetary sections, and I just want to sort of preface this by saying that, of course, the governor's highest priorities of this program that he put in his budget, and those lines are obviously contained here. This is the $30 million for juvenile crime prevention, $20 million for alcohol and drug abuse treatment programs, and $7 million for expansion of Healthy Start. We've also, in a larger budget context, wanted to work to find more money for those early childhood programs. So with that said, I just briefly go through Section 50. It does as a generic allocate money in addition to, and have blanks in addition to that, already allocated to the Healthy Start program and the
commission's budget. Section 51, subsection 1, allocates additional funds to State Commission on Children and Families to be distributed to local commissions for the following programs: for relief nurseries, the existing ones, to expand to 2 additional relief nurseries, to maintain existing family resource centers, to create new family resource centers, to expand the First Steps program, and to provide staff support for leading the coordination of local plans and working with partners to evaluate their plans. Subsection 2 adds resources to the court-appointed special advocate program to the State Commission on Children and Families. Subsection 3 appropriates monies to the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission for the Criminal Crime Prevention Plans. Subsection 4 appropriates monies to the Oregon Youth Authority for the basic services provision of the Juvenile Crime Prevention Plan. Subsection 5 is the budget line for the Alcohol and Drug Program. Section 52 has technical amendments, and Section 53 is emergency clause. An effective date of July 1st, 1990.
Thank you. Question?
Yes, Sir Brown.
We are hearing rumors that the folks are looking at funding this package at $20 million as opposed to $50 plus. I guess my question would be for you, do you envision then all the programs having to tighten their belts, or would you prioritize in certain areas?
Chairman Brown, I've heard a lot of discussion about the budget numbers. I'm not quite clear myself about what that $20 million figure would apply to in and of itself. But if it was all around the juvenile crime prevention plans, that means we would have to reduce the plans that the locals have put forward, the 36 plans we have, by at least a third. If it was spread more broadly, you would just have to reduce those plans even further if you spent $15 million. Behalf, and I don't know what the effects of that number are on the children and families budget. I do know that the commission's budget, the Children and Families Commission budget, has come out of Ways and Means and does have the $7 million in it for the Healthy Start program.
Thank you.
Thank you for the question.
No, Mr. Chair,
sorry,
I'm just checking. You're very complicated, very long. Your practical sense, say, how would this bill apply to, say, the Kinkle case? Would it help that situation? Or, I mean, that's the thrust of this whole thing, isn't it?
Well,
it work in a practical sense?
I'd say the Thurston shooting definitely caused some higher attention to it. Probably 344, Senate Bill 344, which we passed, mm-hmm. would have more of a direct impact on Kim Kemple, because when he was arrested for bringing a firearm to school, he was released to his parents, where under that bill you would be held for psychological evaluation. So that immediate situation would be more appropriately addressed by that. However, this bill is intended to be broader and in the high-risk area, if you notice the risk factors there, hopefully develop programs and sensitive teachers and other professionals who can say this student needs some help.
Long-term, broader type thing.
Right. And then, of course, your early intervention programs are designed to create healthy families that you have fewer Kinkle situations. I don't think we can ever totally eliminate them, but generationally, if we were able to fund those other programs and they worked as well as they have in other areas or in our pilot projects, it would make a huge difference, not only in juvenile crime, but also in students doing better in school and getting better jobs and all those things.
Thank you.
Yes, Senator Duncan.
I'm just curious, Steve, what the resources that will be added to the court-appointed special advocates program, the CUSTA program, do you know to what extent they plan to expand that program?
I probably have a better idea. What we've done by including the blank appropriation line in the bill, it allows us to send this directly down to Ways and Means. As you all know, we cannot appropriate money here. But in the initial governor's budget And in the Senate's Republican budget through the interim, it both had $30 million for the governor's budget was more focused on high-risk youth. The Senate budget said early intervention in high-risk, so it was a broader spectrum. Frankly, the pressure to fund K through 12 has put more pressure on those funds. And the goal, and it's only a goal on CASA, is to find another $400,000 to $500,000. The goal on expanding Healthy Start has already been met by the budget that's been passed. It's a question of whether or not we can keep that additional $7 million there. The relief nursery money previously has primarily come from the federal government, and there are four relief nurseries. The FAT money runs out in September, and so this would provide an option to continue to fund those, but the local relief nurseries would have to come up with a 25% match and be built into the overall coordinated plan. And the idea is to expand relief nurseries. They're also very beneficial. The Hill Walker program on violent behavior, that's $400 per student and family. Again, proven track record, a good early intervention opportunity. And I forget how many pilot projects we have right now in the state. But this would greatly expand that. So, again, this goes down to Ways and Means. It'll go to the Subcommittee on Public Safety, and which is chaired by Representative Westland and Senator Tim serves on it. On the drug and alcohol money, initially, again, in the governor's budget, there was $20 million proposed. The Senate budget had 20 proposed, 18 general fund, $2 million federal match. And my hope is that we'll get that money back, but again, that's going to be a struggle down in Ways and Means. It's probably right now on what I would call an ad back list. Yes, Senator Brown.
I just want to make a comment, because we've been hearing for the last couple of days about pitting human resources against education, and I frankly don't buy that. We have enough money in the state to adequately fund programs for our children, including education. We're choosing not to do it in certain ways, and I don't want people to walk out of this room and believe that we don't have enough money in this state to fund these children's programs, because we do.
Well, the other issue that raised is if you want to invade the cigarette settlement, and then looking into the next biennium, the roll-up costs, and whether or not you'd have, with our current tax system, sufficient revenues to continue the projects you find.
What I'm saying is we're choosing not to look at other resources that are available, and we're choosing to not adequately fund programs for our kids.
Senator Courtney.
Yeah, this is a huge document. I noticed that one of the provisions is supposed to report back what the next president legislature on its progress. Is that correct?
Yes. Yeah.
Now, that means the county is going to be involved. Are they up and running already, even though we haven't allocated money? Are they, to the best of your knowledge, I wonder what kind of report we can see, because the word's going to come down, even though it's an emergency clause in here. How much activity do you think we're going to see in 2 years after we approve this and allocate the money?
The Children and Families Commission is, of course, already up and running. JPAC started with an executive order, so they've been organized, and they've presented their plans and have worked through that. The audit that the Representative Cruz mentioned in Section 46, that report won't come until 3 or 4 years from now, because the interrelationship between the different agencies and programs will not have had sufficient time. But for the next biennium, I think because most of these programs are either continuing programs or expansion with a little different mix, they should be able to report. And what you have, and this concerns local agencies and Children's Families Commission, because
it looks, as you read this, a little overwhelming as far as the planning and then the reporting you have to do and the coordination. So what I hope happens is that there is some continuity between the different groups. For instance, the JPAC group includes two non-voting members from the legislature. I think that's good. I think you'll have better communication, better acceptance if the legislature is involved. Alcohol and drugs, the same, and then the new task force allows the governor to have an appointee, and then drug and alcohol and JPAC to have two appointees each. So I think that will help in the interchange of that information, but I think we'll get a pretty good report or a pretty good feel of how things are working. There's going to be some glitches. There's a fear that this is more of a top-down approach and there's not a lot of flexibility. My hope is that flexibility is there, that what we started in 1993 with 2003 and 2004 will continue, because largely the Children and Families Commissions have been successful. It brings a lot of community volunteers and efforts. And you'll notice twice in this bill the Children Care Team report is referenced oriented and recognized as a leader for following that approach and trying to do this type of comprehensive planning at a local level. So I won't be here, but I would hope that there would be some good solid information. And I know we get a lot of reports. My hope would be, if it's not the Judiciary, some committee would have the three groups come before them on the same day, spend 2 hours, and say, how is it working, and tell us what you have.
Is any of this tied to the e-board?
No. There's not right now. There's no intent to have an e-board reservation. Now, it doesn't mean they can't come back and ask for additional funds. I think we would expect on the e-board that as they apply for new grants and for the expenditure of money, once they receive those grants, that would go through the e-board. But right now, there'll be a very small amount in the e-board, but if there was some emergency or some match that was necessary, the groups here wouldn't be precluded from asking. Other questions? Thank you for your testimony. Thank you for your hard work.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just want to add for the record that I think this bill is really provides us with an outstanding framework across the continuum, and for the first time we really do have the framework for a very complete policy from early childhood to adolescent kids that address the problems we face and the crime prevention and those of our younger children. And really do appreciate everyone's work and all the interest group work and the long time that we've moved forward with this thing. I wanted to say that I don't believe that this reflects so much compromise, more of an evolution of what we all want to accomplish when we begin. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Then the chair would ask the committee to turn for a moment again to page 24 and 25, and I would like to expand the rules so that we could delete, beginning on page 24, lines 21, and continuing that deletion on to page 25 through line 7. Is there objection to the suspension of the rules? Hearing is ordered. Is there objection to the motion or discussion?
Mr. Chair,
yeah.
Line 24 is starting where?
Excuse me, page 24, line 21 to the end of the page, that'd be through line 31, on page 25, line 1 through 7. Is there objection to the deletion? Hearing none, so ordered. Then the chair would move that Senate Bill 555, or triple nickel, as it's been referred to, should be referred to...
I move the dash 14 amendment.
Thank you.
Technically amendment to Senate Bill 555.
Thank you. The good and alert vice chair to my right moves that the dash 14 amendments to 555 as amended be adopted. Discussion? Objection to order.
I move the third bill. Do you want to make
this? I want to make this.
I'm so sorry. Please forgive me.
Yeah, you know it.
Mr. Chair, I just want to say I thought Pam Curtis and Steve Marks did an incredible job. I know there were a lot of other players, but you guys did an incredible job on this
trip. We're going to miss the quality time we spent together over the past few weeks, I'm sure. The chair then would move Senate Bill 555 as amended to Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation. Objection? Objection? Thank you, committee, for your patience and tolerance.
Are we all done?
No.
Where?
Yeah. No, we're not done. Okay. Committee, let us go back then to Bill. Okay. Bill. Yeah. Beyond what we're going to complete our agenda. Did we do that already?
We did not.
Okay. Committee, the chair then would move to suspend the rules in order that we might reconsider House Bill 2224. Is there objection? Hearing no order. The rules being suspended, the chair moves that we reconsider the vote, wherein we send House Bill 2224 to the floor with a due pass recommendation so that we can discuss the possible conflict amendment. Is there objection? Hearing none. Ordered. And?
Mr. Chair, it's my understanding from my co-counsel, Mr. Felton, that we're looking at a four amendment as conflict amendment to the bill that you already passed out of committee.
Thank you. I think we have in your packet the conflict amendments. They're the dash A4s. The chair would move the dash A4 amendments to House Bill 2224. Is there discussion? Objection? So ordered. The chair then would move House Bill 2224 to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Discussion? Objection? So ordered. And we'll have the same carrier who was...
I don't have a chair.
All right. Do we have any other conflict amendments or have we covered
them? We have a correction to make on 2230.
The chair would move to suspend the rules on House Bill 2230 for purposes of possible reconsideration. Objection? The chair then would move that we reconsider our vote where we sent House Bill 2230 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Objection? Hearing none. So ordered. The bill is now before us. And?
Again, this is from Mr. Felton. I understand that the committee passed out the dash 1 and dash 3 amendments to House Bill 2230 and bring it back before you today to correct that in that only the dash 3 amendments were to be adopted.
So
those are before you now.
Do we need to adopt the dash?
No, they reconsidered one of
those. All right. We reconsidered the vote where we adopted the dash 1 and dash 3. The chair would move only the adoption of the dash 3 amendments to House Bill 2230. Discussion? Objection? So the chair then would move House Bill 2230 be sent to the floor with a due pass recommendation. As amended. Discussion? Objection? So ordered. Thank you. Do we have any other easy ones?
House Bill 2806 is the purpose of the referral to the Senate Committee on Public Affairs.
All right.
2806.
All right. We'll open that up. Work session on House Bill 2806. The chair would move this bill. Go to the government.
Senate Committee on Public Affairs.
Senate Committee on Public Affairs. Discussion?
Without recommendation.
Without recommendation.
Thank you.
Objection.
It's a good move.
No order. For those in the audience that understand, that was the smoking bill on whether or not to allow local jurisdictions to. make that decision or the state.
Just for the record, vote inflation. I'm not getting this, and I really will vote about it.
I understand. All right. Let me do one if I could. I think that I'm going to open a work session on Health Bill 2721. There are no amendments. We took public testimony on this last time, and it was came from the House. Max Williams explained the purpose of the bill, and then Robert Neuberger from the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association explained his opposition. Let me speak to this, and then I intend to move the bill. This is 2721. It deals with summary judgment. No, this is not a conflict.
There's no amendments.
There's no amendments to it. We haven't been in a work session on it before. The purpose of this bill is to change the Oregon summary judgment rule by requiring that the party which bears the burden of proving the material fact at trial will also bear the same evidentiary burden in moving for or opposing the motion for summary judgment. In 1995, we passed Senate Bill 385, which was a very lengthy bill. But a portion of that included a statement on summary judgment. In it, we mirrored the language of Rule 56 of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure. The language was identical. By the way, summary judgment is a pretrial method by which either party, plaintiff or defendant, may file a motion and affidavit and try to have the case dismissed before trial, and you allege that there's no genuine issue of a material fact. And if you're successful, I mean, if you can show there's no genuine issue, you should be granted your motion for summary judgment, and then the trial court rules in your favor. However, if there is a material fact in question, you can't have a summary judgment, and you go on to trial. Well, and that's covered under in Oregon law, under Oregon CP 47. Well, as I said, we adopted the federal standard. That was our intention. And the reason for doing that was, although the language was the same in the federal and the state law, the state courts, the Court of Appeals, seemed less willing to grant summary judgment motions than the federal courts. So we said we want to go to the federal standard, and it was for a public policy purpose of it. If it should be granted, then you don't have to incur additional attorney fees, go to trial, etc. It frees up court time and both plaintiff and defendant time. Well, the legislature said this was a good policy, and if you recall, Professor Brunette from Lewis and Clark College, Northwestern School of Law, was quoted by Robert Neuberger, and he also said in the hearing, and by the way, on these issues, we had 30 to 40 hours of hearing in 1995. To the extent that Senate Bill 385 is aimed at reducing the number of frivolous suits that are brought in Oregon courts, it has a salutary purpose. Frivolous litigation is a problem and needs to be deterred. However, there is already an excellent procedure designed to reduce sham or frivolous suits, summary judgment. And so he referenced summary judgment as a way to do it. He didn't like most of what we were doing on 385, but he thought the summary judgment section made sense. In my floor comments when I carried the bill in 95, I said that the amendment to ORR CP 47C is intended to give the court significantly greater latitude in disposing of cases by way of summary judgment, especially where the opposing party has no evidence to support his or her claim. It makes sense. It saves both attorneys' fees, both sides' attorneys' fees and costs. So the idea was that if you file a motion for summary judgment, and if you're on the other side, you have an obligation to refute it by an affidavit saying, no, that's not true, or there is some fact that is in dispute. And that's called just shifting the burden, and that's what the U.S. Supreme Court requires in their federalized rule on summary judgment. Well, after that bill was passed, signed by the governor, the Court of Appeals had a case involving its interpretation and agreed with what we did. In fact, they cited in testimony not only what I said, but also Representative Williams, who, of course, at that time was just my chief legal counsel on civil matters. So he was very excited about it, to be quoted in the Court of Appeals. I think he said it to all his relatives. And this was the Jones versus General Motors case. The Supreme Court reversed the Court of Appeals and refused to look at the legislative history. And we kind of scratched our heads about why. And they didn't then stop our intention of going to the federal interpretation. So that's why this bill is brought before you today. We're attempting now, by spelling it out, and it is spelled out, what we intend to do in the summary judgment, Well, they determined...
Was it not like, or was it just the way it...
They didn't have to go to the history. They said the language is clear on its face. And it's the same... we had adopted the federal statute, and so they determined that we adopted the federal statute, but we didn't adopt the interpretation that there was a shifting of the burden once the motion was filed. And they said they didn't have to go to legislative history, because the statute was clear on its face, and if the legislature wanted to say that this requires the other party to file an affidavit and shift the burden, the legislature should say so. And that's what we're saying today. Yes, Member Reed.
Just for curiosity, what bearing did that have on the substance of the case and the justice of General Motors? Because as I recall, that's the one where they successfully sued General Motors for the side settled. Is this the one?
No.
Oh, this is
a different case.
Different case.
What it caused then was the motion for summary judgment, they said, was the judge's interpretation, the Court of Appeals interpretation was wrong, and we sent it back to the trial court.
So they ruled that the trial court wrongfully granted the summary judgment?
Right. Wrong, and that the Court of Appeals interpretation was an error.
And the Court of Appeals upheld the summary judgment?
Right. And used our legislative history for the justification of doing it, that there was, in fact, an intent to shift the burden once the affidavit was filed.
So they're not arguing the legal system, just the way we said it.
Just the way we said it. And the Court of Appeals, the Supreme Court said, if you really meant that, then you should say that in the statute. And that's what we're doing. So with that, the chair would move House Bill 2721 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Objection? Sore? I think I'll carry this again. It's just deja vu. I will enjoy it. Okay. Thank you, sir. Alright. I think that the court reporter bill is going to take a little time. We have some amendments that should move fairly quickly in House Bill 2474. So let's go into work session on 2474 first, and I'll invite Dave Honeycutt and John Chandler with the dash A5 amendments which the committee should have.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. John Chandler, Director of Governmental Affairs for the Oregon Building Industry Association, here on House Bill 2474, the dash A5 amendment. In your earlier hearing on this bill, Mr. Tim Circum, an attorney put it forward, who represents the local government, raised some concerns about the bill. We met in the hallway and met with West Council and came up with the dash 5 amendments, which addressed Mr. Circum's concerns in part. The balance of Mr. Circum's concerns can be addressed through testimony on the record, Mr. Chairman, if you will indulge us when we get to that point, to clarify some of the language in the bill.
What specifically do the dash A5 amendments do as they reference Mr. Circum's concerns?
Do you have Mr. Circum's letter in front of you?
Yes, I do.
Part of the record. The first concern he raises is on page 2 of his letter, making clear that this is a prospective measure only. And the dark language on the dash A5 section 3, the new section 3, does that. Section 3 applies to conditions imposed after the effective date.
After the effective date, I see that.
The second portion of his first concern is clarifying that it's only the applicants who can avail themselves of this procedure, not the intervener or someone else. That, we believe, unless counsel, Mr. Kirk and I discussed it, unless counsel drafted it, is the new language in Section 6 of the bill, as is on the A5, the section applies to appeals by the applicant of a condition of approval and claims filed in state court. So making it clear that this isn't going to open up a Johnny Brook with interveners or cross-appellants, anything of that sort. With regard to Mr. Circum's other points, he raised one, as did Mr. Richard Whitman from the State Department of Justice, with regard to the raise-it-or-waive-it standard. It's This bill does nothing to the raise of the waiver standard, which currently exists in the LUBA statute 197-830, I believe, which says that you have to raise issues at the local level in order to maintain those issues on appeal. That's the law right now. This bill does nothing to change that. Ledge Council agrees with that interpretation, I think, as do Mr. Kirk and Mr. Whitman now. There was some concern that there is no such raise of the waiver provision with regard to circuit court actions for inverse condemnation. And that doesn't right. That's the case now. This bill doesn't change that either. There is no such standard. We would point out, though, and we pointed this out to Mr. Shurkum and Mr. Whitman, I think, to their satisfaction, that the current statute of limitations for an inverse condemnation action is 6 years. By the terms of this bill, is now 180 days to file that. So the issue of raising or waiving it is a much shorter time clock for local governments. Also, Mr. Shurkum raised the issue of estoppel. And I wanted to make it clear on the record, the hypothetical he pointed out in his letter where a developer proposed conditions, accepted them, did the project, sued under this bill for damages, and will not be stopped. That's not the intention of this bill. I think as an attorney, that would be a very risky case to bring, particularly given the attorney's fees clause in the bill. We're not trying to eliminate that aspect of an estoppel defense. We are trying to say, and the bill does say, that acceptance of a condition is not a waiver of the right to challenge. But any agreed upon condition that a developer accepts, absolutely, that would not be the basis for an action under this bill. And I think Mr. Serkin, I still might state that on the record. I hope I did so clearly enough. That was not the intention of the bill to give a loophole for clever developers. I don't think the loophole exists, for one thing, and I think it would be too risky. But to the extent that legislative history can clarify that, I will place that on the record. Other than that, Mr. Chairman, those are the... there is one more change, Mr. Chairman, if I might, and this was just called to my attention in the hallway, and it's a very minor one, on line 19 and 20 of the printed bill, for the Dan Gross. This deals with the issue of exhausting local remedies, which was a critical part of the negotiations between us and local governments on this bill. The sentence currently reads, however, an applicant must exhaust all local appeals provided in the local comprehensive plan and land use regulations prior to pursuing an appeal under this section. So just pointed out to me in the hallway, and I agree that the term appeal is not quite broad enough. Cases under this bill that would go to LUBA are appeals. Cases under this bill that go to circuit court on inverse condemnation are not appeals. We would propose striking the words pursuing an appeal and inserting the word proceeding. So the sentence would read, however, an applicant must exhaust all local appeals provided in the local comprehensive plan and land use regulations prior to proceeding under this section. That way we cover both the circuit court and LUBA angles.
Yes, could you do that one more time, Senator Duncan? Let me repeat it just so I may understand. On line 19, page 1, dropping the words pursuing an appeal and instead say proceeding. Is that correct?
That's correct, Mr. Chairman.
Are there questions concerning the Dash A5 amendments or the interlineation that was just discussed?
Mr. Chairman, with the committee's indulgence, I would like to state also on the record appreciation for the work the cities and counties did on this bill. We had most of it done on the House side, but we had a very good process, I think, of putting a bill together in the House Civil Judiciary Committee, and their patience and forbearance is greatly appreciated, and I think contributed to a much better piece of legislation.
Thank you.
Seneca,
do you have anything to add on the Dash A5 amendments before the interlineation?
Chair Bryan, members of the committee, Dave Honeycutt, Oregonians in Action. The only thing that I would add, if there are any concerns about the estoppel argument, I don't think the chances of an estoppel argument being raised are very slim, since we've gone down from a 6-year statute of limitations to a 180-day statute of limitations. The time for a local government to act in reliance of the accepting the conditions by the developer is very limited, so I don't think we're going to face situations where the local government has acted in reliance on the developer's agreement to accept the conditions. And if that is the case, as Mr. Chandler indicated, I'll indicate as well, we are not intending to override an estoppel defense in those situations.
Thank you. committee were in work session, the chair would then would move the dash A5 amendments to House Bill 2474. Discussion? Objection? Or chair then would move on line, on page 1, line 19 and line 20, that there be a deletion of the word pursuing an appeal and in its place say proceeding. Discussion? Objection? And I'm suspending the rules, I guess, to do this. Thank you. So ordered. The chair then would move House Bill 2474 to the floor to pass recommendation as amended. Discussion?
Mr. Chair,
yes.
I just want to abstain. I didn't hear the testimony, and I read it before, but I have a couple of questions, and I think I'm sure Mr. Chandler can answer, but I'll stay today. If I'm not.
Okay.
I'd like the energy to know I may change on the House Bill, but I'd be good to vote.
Thank you. Please enter Senator Burdick as a no, and Senator Brown is excused. No one, I don't see it. Motion carries. Okay. Who wants to carry it? I'll carry it.
He wants to carry it.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Senator Burdick, Senator Brown will carry. I'm confident you'll sway air between now and when it comes up. All right, let us go back to court reporters. And I believe that's House Bill 2731. And the witness book, please. Yes, if you wanted to.
Public affairs.
Right.
Which one is there?
I think Senator Clinton is around and he might be registered if you know.
No.
So.
Okay.
All right. From what? Not even know.
Did chance for all he's one of
them. A big one?
I'm smoking.
Oh, yeah.
It's pretty hard line.
No. Well, we did it without recommendation.
Oh, okay.
All right. We've got
two more votes.
Me too.
All right. All right. No, I need four votes.
You want me to be recording for no one?
All right.
What do you want to do?
Please, without objection, please record Senator Brown and Senator Courtney has no on House Bill 2806, which is the vote to send it to public affairs without recommendation. It will not change the outcome. Thank you. And then Senator Courtney would like to vote on Senator Courtney would like to vote aye on Senate Bill 2721. Will not change the outcome without objection. It's ordered. I'll now invite Carl Myers, Paul Romaine, and Dave Omar. Paul Romaine, yes, yeah, all of you.
Court.
Now, I used to, I went to high school with someone named Omar, and his father was a realtor.
Senator Brown, you're talking about Bob Omar, my friend cousin, his father was Lee Omar. Also served in the legislature many years ago.
Okay, that's who it is. Is he still alive?
Lee Omar passed away a few years ago. Bob Omar is now the senior owner of Omar and Caliber Realtors.
Okay. I'll give him my bill.
I'll do that.
Carl, why don't you go first since this is your bill.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Carl Myers on behalf of the Oregon Court Reporters Association. I will not, unless you request, go into a long explanation of the need for this bill. I think that Representative Williams and Representative Walker have addressed that in their comments earlier. It certainly is in my written comments that are being passed out now, and we had a long hearing over on the House side, and I think the vote out of the House committee and the vote on the House floor indicates the need. I would like to address some concerns that have been raised about the bill in its current form, and I have taken the liberty of passing out to you page 580, a copy of the CSR certificate holder rules or duties, so that you can put that in context. Let me explain what the CSR CSR certificate is. We have in Oregon a voluntary association for certified shorthand recorders that is administered by the State Court Administrator's Office and sets ethical standards for court reporters who voluntarily are a part of that. You will see in paragraph 6 of section 4.1, disclose and provide to all parties and counsel to the proceedings the same services at the same fee rate for proceedings in the entire case and for the transcript and copy charges. The concerns that Representative Williams raised when he testified at the beginning of your session today, we intend 2731 to sort of mirror the duties of CSR for all court reporters because we think those are important to keep that court reporting profession, the deposition process to be unbiased and unprejudiced. Both parties treated the same. You can't discount to one side and then gouge your money out of the other. So House Bill 2731 establishes duties and responsibilities for all court reporters in the state of Oregon, not just CSRs, because again, not all court reporters are members of CSRs. We wish they would be. Then, quite honestly, House Bill 2731 would not be necessary. We ask you to take a look at those duties because those have been developed by the courts to administer that program, and we think those ethical requirements set a minimum for what ought to be required in this process. 2731 has been, or its concept has been reviewed by a number of states. Mr. Omart is here from the National Court Reporters Association. He is a local court reporter in Marion County Circuit Court, but he can address the states that have that are dealing with this problem. It is not so common in Oregon as it is on the West Coast and in the Midwest and some large metropolitan areas where to gain an advantage, one party may hire a court reporting firm and have the court reporter firm discount to them and charge high rates to the other side, perhaps give the deposition to them on a quicker basis than they would to the other side to try to gain an advantage in an adversarial position. That is the very crux of which the court reporters oppose. We think they ought to be and continue to be officers of the court and to serve in an unbiased, unprejudiced way without obligation to either side. This bill has a disclosure portion that if they have a financial or long-term financial arrangement with either side, they need to disclose that to the parties to a deposition and allow the parties to that deposition to determine whether they want to proceed with that court reporter or to obtain another one. We think that's simply fair. The notice so that an attorney on behalf of his client can decide whether that court reporter, because of that financial relationship, is one that ought to be trusted or not, and that 2731 only infers or puts a duty on or responsibilities on court reporters. It does not force attorneys to do anything. They have the right to opt in or out of a deposition that is handled by a court reporter with an inappropriate or a contractual relationship. We would ask that 2731A be passed as is without amendment. I would be happy to answer any questions either now or after Mr. Williams has spoken.
Why don't we take the testimony of all the witnesses before we ask questions? Mr. Omart, why don't you go next, and then we'll go to Mr. Williams.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm David Omart. As Mr. Meyer said, I'm a court reporter here in Oregon, have been for 34 years now. I'm also on the board of directors of the National Court Reporters Association, a 32,000-member organization. We strongly support this kind of legislation across the country now, because of the problems Mr. Myers mentioned. We currently now have 13 states, as of last week, Indiana being the newest one, that have adopted rules and regulations and legislation concerning this issue, and 22 other states are in the process of it with their legislatures right now. So we wholly support this bill and urge your passage of it. I could go into more depth on it, but as Mr. Myers said there, unless you have some questions, I'll just defer because of time.
Paul. We won't set it yet. The egg timer joke is, if you recall last year, I
sometimes Mr. Romaine can be rather lengthy. And so I bought an egg timer, and I said he had 1 minute. There was no opposition to the bill. If he exceeded the minute, I wasn't going to go into work session.
Never spoken so fast in my life. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Paul Romaine. I'm here representing a company called Amerinet, which is a court reporting service that hires court reporters and contracts with companies or large firms to provide court reporting services all around the country. And you're going to have to understand a little bit of history. I agree with most of what Mr. Meyer said, but his perception is a wee bit different than mine. The original 2731 was just an outright ban on contracting. In other words, you couldn't contract long-term with a court reporter. And by the time the committee finished, original hearing finished, it became very obvious that contracting wasn't the problem. It was particular potential abuses that could come out of anything, not contracting necessarily. So then Mr. Myers and Representative Williams basically got together and drafted what you have as 2731 in front of you. We received these amendments basically the day of the hearing, and we said to the committee, we won't, you know, at first glance, everything looked reasonable. If we had any problems, we would bring them to the Senate committee. We didn't want to step in the way, since they did take into the consideration our concerns about just the general concept of contracting. So after review, I have a couple of minor points on this legislation that I think are very significant. One is, you heard two conflicting statements here today, one by Representative Williams on his interpretation and one by Mr. Myers on his interpretation, and that is a significant problem to us. We didn't bring you amendments for that because, frankly, when I talked to Mr. Myers yesterday, the interpretation was the same as Mr. Representative Williams, and now it's not, so let me point that out. Basically, in Section 2, Subsection 2, where it says any person employed or otherwise engaged to record or report a deposition, et cetera, must provide equal services, providing or making available copies of the record or report, et cetera. Our interpretation of that and Representative Williams' interpretation of that was for a single deposition. A single deposition is I depose one of you, for example, or we arrange for somebody to depose one of you with court reporter A. If we then arrange to depose another one of you with the same court reporter can charge a different fee. They're free to charge a different fee because it's a different service to a different person that you are asking them to report for. It really depends. Court reporter's fee depends on who is really arranging it. For example, different market areas may have different fees, different because of contract relationships, because of long-term, just personal relationships, you may have different fee arrangements with a court reporter. And what you're saying with Mr. Meyer's interpretation is not the same as Mr. Williams or Representative Williams' interpretation. The same way that attorneys actually can charge different fees to different clients for the same services.
Paul,
if I read this on line 23, it says engaged to record or report a deposition. If it were if the word depositions were plural, I might agree with your concern about interpretation, but I thought a deposition was fairly clear.
Mr. Chair, Senator Brown, if your interpretation is correct and if legislative history is sufficient with Representative Williams and your statement, I would agree and I have no problem. I have a problem when the sponsor of the bill comes up and says it's, in effect, designed to do something a little bit different. And if it is, I would like some clarifying language in the bill. We're not trying to kill the thing. We would just like some clarifying language, which you could put in about a single deposition. But it's fine with me, as long as the understanding is that for each separate deposition, you can, in effect, charge a different fee. Now, everybody to that deposition, every party to that deposition is going to get the same fee. But if you depose a different person, it could be a different fee. That's number one concern. Number two concern is on the back. Section 4, the reporting or the disclosing requirement.
This requires a disclosure if the person has a contract to provide reporting services for deposition on a full or part-time basis for any of the following persons. Okay, sounds innocent enough. The problem is, what is a contract? What if you have a situation where I have a long-standing relationship with a court reporter, and I agree that I'm going to use him or her for the deposition, all my depositions, and they're going to give me a little break on the fee because I use them all the time. Is that a contract? Probably is. How do you define what a contract is? Who has to disclose in those situations, and are you getting into a situation where you're going to be subject to litigation over whether or not there was proper disclosure? That becomes a problem. The other thing that really bothers me about this is, having worked as an attorney and know the relationships sometimes of court reporters and attorneys, there's a lot of other things I'd rather know than a contract. Frankly, I'd rather know if somebody has a relationship with one of the court reporters, which sometimes happens. There are many other things that I would like to see disclosed that are beyond this. So I have a problem with that disclosure. My client can handle the disclosure just fine. We have a form that we put out there. And we've tried to come up with some language that would make this disclosure section a little better, and we haven't, and that's why we're not presenting it to you. My client will handle it just fine because we disclose in all situations. But where you are going to run into problems is in a situation where somebody really wants to use this as a way to delay. So those are the two things. You know, it was interesting when we first had this hearing in the House. Representative Werbelow actually made the comment, looks like we have a solution in need of a problem. Because the only thing the proponents couldn't point to was the need for the bill. What happened in Oregon that requires us to have this bill? When they say they talk for the CSR, it's a minority of the court reporters that really belong to this thing. Now, maybe it's the coming thing, I don't know. But I've been informed it's a minority of the court reporters. And it may be the good thing to do, but you're going to need a little more discussion on it, on where you want to go. Do you really want to interfere in this situation? The original intent of this bill, and we still think the total intent of this bill, is to try and limit those who can, in effect, limit a practice that is trying to, in effect, control runaway costs. Insurance companies, law firms, other sort of national companies are trying to somehow control costs. So they're looking for contract relationships where they know if they go to X, the fee is going to be a reasonable fee, and they won't get gouged by it. And actually, everybody in that particular deposition gets the benefit of that fee. So we're not against the bill as long as that one particular provision is taken care of. I have pointed out some concerns about Section 4, and if you so choose to remove it, you'd probably be wise. You probably would be back in here 2 years from now modifying it if you don't, but that's up to you. It won't affect my client. Thank you very much.
Questions for the witnesses?
Sure.
Yes, Senator Duncan.
Okay, Paul, once again, you want to change the point?
What? Mr. Chair, Senator Duncan, what I would do, and this came up, I'm sorry I don't have legislative council amendments for you because this came up just actually in kind of listening to two different things come out about interpretation, is the line 26 where it says providing or making available copies of the record or report. What I would do after report, I would insert of a single deposition. And I would insert the same language on the page 2, line 2, at the end, making equal charges to all parties for the cost of the record or report of a single deposition. I think that clarifies that particular issue.
And, Mr. Chair?
Yes,
exactly. You're saying that actually line 23 is rather clear.
When I first read, Mr. Chair, Senator Duncan, when I first read this bill, my interpretation was one of a deposition. That's Representative Williams' interpretation. But, you know, just because you're paranoid doesn't mean somebody's not out to get you. When I hear people who are pushing the bill saying a little different interpretation, I get nervous about it.
Well, maybe Carl, is your interpretation
subsection 2 of section 2 different than what Paul just said?
Well, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I was here when Representative Williams spoke. He was talking about if a court reporter that was flown to another part of the state or had to do a rush deposition could charge extra for that as long as it was equal to both parties. And that part of Representative Williams' discussion, I don't disagree with. That's our interpretation of that section as well. What we are trying to avoid with this is that a court reporter will charge one party. There will be several depositions when there are, say, a plaintiff and a defendant in any case. They will take several depositions. Some will be ordered by one side, and some will be ordered by the other. The one that orders the deposition often orders the original, and a copy is then provided to the other party, the side whose party was deposed in a typical deposition session. And there are two charges. There's a charge for the original and a charge for the copy. We think those should be different charges because there's different amounts involved or different preparation involved. What we're talking about is a court reporter that charges Senator Bryant for all his depositions $5 a page and charges me when I'm on the other side for the original twice as much. Shows favoritism to one side or the other in charging for depositions. There are going to be cases where they have to go out to a different area, or they do it on a Saturday or something, that there will be additional charges for, or a surcharge. But we want both sides need to be treated equally in the charging. We think that the disclosure section takes care of part of that problem because if, in fact, as Mr. Romaine points out, they have a long-term contract so that they will give a discounted rate for, because you've been a long-term contract, I give you my court reporting services exclusively and you give me a discount, that will come out in the disclosure section and can be handled by the attorney objecting to that court reporter in that operation. Again, I take a look, I refer you to the duties of the CSR, what the Supreme Court has determined to be an ethical standard for court reporters that get that certification. We think that's the ethical standard that ought to be applied to all court reporters. There are about 200 CSRs in this state, and that is a majority, I would think, of the court reporters. But if a court reporter doesn't like the ethical standards of the CSRs, they're free to drop their membership and then essentially not have any ethical standards because there are none in statute, with the exception of the possible passage of 2731, which is what we're asking you to do today.
I'm a little confused in that I don't try cases anymore, but occasionally in the past when we take depositions and someone from Portland would bring the court reporter, and for a variety of reasons. At one time we didn't have many court reporters in Central Oregon, or someone wasn't available, and frequently the Portland court reporter was more automated, so there'd be a faster turnaround time for producing it. So that reporter would either drive over or fly over. Now, I, as the then attorney, didn't pay that transportation cost. That was picked up by the Portland attorney. And is this bill intended to stop that from happening?
I don't think Section 2 changes that whatsoever.
Okay.
I think that's what Representative Mack, Representative Williams' testimony was too.
And then similar, like if you want it in a hurry, they charge you an extra penny a page. The attorney making that request and paying it would would be legitimate also.
There are market costs out there if you'll notice the CFR rules require disclosure of rates. So that's known up front.
Then the final one, and you're right, what happens, if I request the deposition, the practice is I get the original, I pay a higher amount for that, the other attorney gets a copy, pays a lesser amount. And so those charges are not identical. Your point is then when the shoe is on the other foot, and it's frequently in the same case when they take the deposition
at the same time
of my client at the same time, that same exchange rate at the same time. If it's 6 months later and your rates go up, this shouldn't affect it. Right? As long as your rates have gone up uniformly.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee on it, the problem here is charging the same rate to both sides, whatever it is at the time on there. If 6 months from now, to the side that you might have the relationship with, if you would charge, say, 50 cents or a dollar a page for the copy there, then the other side on that deposition shouldn't have to pay $2 or $3 for their copy. In other words, it's been a padding situation across the country, that the discounts they're giving to the one side as a preferred customer, they're making up for on the other side to the other litigants involved, and that's what we're trying to prevent.
So in my example, though, there's a six-month lag before they take the other deposition. If it's a 5% increase that you've decided to start at the first of the year because you want to make more money, your costs are going up, you're not precluded from charging that additional 5% as long as you, in the future, do uniformly, correct?
Yes. That's my understanding.
Very well.
Paul, I was smiling when you talked about keeping costs down for court reporters, and it's been a long time since I used one, but my recollection is that court reporters' fees are substantially less than the lawyer fees. Has that changed?
Mr. Chair, Representative Senator Brown, not to get demoted yet. I have no clue because I don't go into court. I'm paid by Court Reporter Association to talk about this bill. But I will, if I may, Mr. Chair, respond. I'm losing my train of thought. In a normal case situation, if I notice a deposition with my court reporter, the one I want to use all the time, and that we have that fee, the other side's going to be charged whatever fee I've negotiated. Now, if you want to notice a deposition, you don't have to use my court reporter. There is no requirement. The only time you can use any court reporter you want. And if you don't like the fee that my court reporter will charge, then use a different court reporter. It doesn't cost any more or less. It's your choice to figure out which court reporter you want to use. What you're saying with this interpretation, which is not Representative Williams' interpretation, and definitely wasn't my interpretation originally, which is that once you're used in a case, once you agree to be in a case, you're locked into charging everybody the same amount, basically, in that case at all times. If you have to be, in effect, you have to charge everybody the same amount if you agree to go into that case.
Yeah. How's that different? I assume arbitrators are required to charge parties equally. I assume there's one fee that's usually split. But
right.
If you want somebody to be an unbiased participant, shouldn't they be charging all the parties equally?
Senator Brown, we're trying to figure out what does the fee charge for court reporting have to do with being unbiased or not. It has nothing to do with it. Basically, what you've done is, for example, if you come to me for alcoholic beverage control work, not that you would, but if you did, and you had a tavern, and Senator Courtney had a tavern, and you both had the same, really hypothetical.
I know. Thank you.
He has yours, seriously.
There's another reason he said that.
If you came to me for work, I could decide that you have the ability to pay more than Senator Courtney, and I could charge you different amounts for the exact same work before the Liquor Control Commission. Why are you saying to a court reporter, in effect what you're saying to a court reporter is, if you have a situation where you have a relationship with yourself or some other attorney, that whatever you agree to charge that person if they use you, you agree to charge everybody else in that case. And if that's the policy decision that you want to make,
you can go ahead and do it. We don't understand why you would want to, in effect, interfere with that situation and interfere with the ability of court reporters to contract with whomever they wish. Now, in that particular deposition, any kind of fees have to be identical. We agree with that. And that's what we charge. We charge identical fees for everybody. If you want extra services, the fees are the same. If you want a rush, the fees are the same. Obviously, one person gets the original, but every other party to that action, everybody gets a copy at the same price. Anybody who wants a copy gets a copy at the same price. But if we go on to depose witness B, we think we should have the ability to charge a different fee, depending on whether we want to or not. Thank you. Other questions?
On
sure. Okay. Yes. Maybe I just didn't hear. Paul has a suggestion that of a single position in two spots. You opposed that.
We opposed that because that, again, Mr. Chair, Senator Duncan, that allows then the court reporter to show favoritism to one side by treating one party with a lower rate and another party at a higher rate. Often depositions are taken the same day. You bring the plaintiff in and the defendant in. You have them around the table. You take both depositions at the same time. If Mr. Romaine, his interpretation would be the case, then that single deposition of one party, then you would have another deposition of the other party, and everybody sitting around the table would be getting different fees. And we want to avoid where the court reporter appears to be biased to one side by treating them financially different than the other. We expect unbiased in our court system, and in such an important part of litigation as a deposition, the court reporter ought to be unbiased. Remember, this bill is being brought to you by the Court Reporters Association. It's not being brought to you by attorneys or others, although if you take a look at my handout, you'll see that this kind of legislation is endorsed by the American Judges Association, the State Court Administrator, the Oregon State Bar's Practice and Procedure Committee, the American Trial Lawyers Association, etc. But we are reporters that are asking for limits being put on us to protect the integrity of our profession and the deposition process.
If I can make one final comment, Mr. Chair. Thank you. There is a very easy way to handle a situation if there are depositions on the same day. If you're going to use one court reporter, ask the court reporter, what are you going to charge us? You're going to charge everybody the same? Great. If you're not, we'll bring a different court reporter in. There are plenty of ways besides statute limiting what people can do in business to handle situations. What this is pure and simple. If you go back to the original 2731 and what's happened here, an attempt to somehow keep some organizations out of court reporting. And it's a way to limit the market. And we'll go along with that, at least trying to get at some of the abuses, as long as they are true abuses, as we agreed to. Make equal services available. Make sure the record can't be sent out. One of the abuses that was brought up was that the disk somehow gets sent out of state with some reporter services, and the court reporter loses control. Well, we don't do that, and we put in here, or agreed with the association to put in here, the situation where the court reporter had to keep control of that disk. And we think that's a good thing.
Here is a suggestion that I have on equal charges, because it's not clear to me that you could, for instance, tack on a surcharge for travel or for...
Mr. Chair, can I address that on page 2, line 2, making equal charges to all parties for the costs of the record? And I think that would include travel costs and other costs that would be associated, also rising costs of doing business that could be passed on.
Well, what I was thinking of saying, which
you know, which does not, I was going to add something, which does not include it's easy to say it does not include cost of travel, but for expedited services, the same point would apply. If you charge someone $50 for the expedited service, you want that same charge rather than $200 if the other side wants it. So, that's one that I'm stumbling with. On section 4, I had two other questions we haven't addressed. It says, has a contract either full-time or part-time basis. I understand what you're getting at here, but a contract, anytime you hire a court reporter, to me that's a contract. And I don't think that's what you're after. You're looking at some sort of more of a relationship.
Mr. Chair, I would direct your attention to line 23 of page 2. This section does not apply to contracts for court reporting services for a single deposition, case, or incident. That would get rid of the situation where you call your court reporter and say, can you be in my office 2 weeks from now for a deposition? That's a single case. This bill also allows for those financial, the contract to be, let's say you have a major case, a class action suit with a lot of folks involved. That would be a single case or incident, so you would not need to report those financial arrangements. We're talking about a long-term financial arrangement, whether in writing or not, where one party agrees to do all the deposition work or to have all the deposition work sent to them in exchange for some kind of a rate or other preferential treatment. And, Mr. Chair, I need to reference this. Those arrangements are not illegal under the bill. They only need to be noticed to the party so that they can decide whether to accept that arrangement or not. We do not, for instance, forbid by this bill Marinette's operations here in Oregon or otherwise. We simply want it on the record, up front, announced by the court reporter, and the court reporter will know if the court reporter has that kind of a relationship. Often the attorney will not know because the arrangements might be made through an office manager at the firm, or a paralegal sets up the deposition, won't know about a financial arrangement. The court reporter will. The court reporter announces it out front, and then the attorneys can decide whether that's, and in many cases, Mr. Chair, as you may remember from your practice, many law firms use the same court reporter whenever they can. A simple disclosure that we always use XYZ reporting firm will probably not upset the deposition process because everybody knows that. And if they trust XYZ reporting firm, they're not going to walk away from the deposition. But it is upfront. It is knowledge.
Right. In that situation, though, if we 80% of the time use the same court reporter, we wouldn't have to make a disclosure anyway because we don't have any contract.
There's not a contract.
It's just that we like the services of that particular.
If you do it on a case-by-case basis, leaving you free to contract ABZ reporting firm the next time.
Mr. Chair. Then one final point, and then Paul will get to you. On line 22 of page 4, it says not required to pay any fee. If you make the objection, if you make the disclosure at the time of taking the deposition, understand that, and then you say you object for these reasons, and that court reporter has come from Portland, then your position would be that the attorney who brought that court reporter would have to pay the fee?
If there's any fee that the court reporter demands at that point, such as an appearance fee, that will have a bit of a chilling effect on last-minute announcements because attorneys with a financial arrangement with a court reporter will probably announce that at the time or have the court reporter announce it at the time, and they'll be able to avoid those kinds of situations. But what we wanted to avoid was an attorney getting faced with a disclosure that there is the other side has a financial arrangement and feeling that they couldn't walk away from that deposition even though they knew it was against their client's best interest without exposing their client to some at least fee for the appearance. And we don't want to harm an innocent party who objects to an improper relationship or what they believe to be an improper relationship.
Does the court have discretion if this became an issue, to decide whether or not a party should have to pay that fee. I'm thinking, and it doesn't often happen, but occasionally that might be a trial tactic or for some reason.
Most court reporters, if they cannot collect the fee, will go to small claims court to collect it, and it will get litigated if the court reporter believes that they are due a fee and that the objection was improper.
What I want to do is not preclude the attorney who brought the court reporter from raising with the court the ability to recover the fee in that particular case.
It could come up in process of disbursement. Okay. Mr. Chair.
All right. Paul, you had a comment?
Just a couple of things on the disclosure portion of it. Again, we don't have a particular problem with that disclosure because we actually do have a form. Our court reporter here uses a form that she presented at the earlier hearing that shows exactly how it's disclosed, and we've never had a problem. She has never been excused from a deposition or anything, and if she was, she wouldn't record it just out of natural ability. Let me just go back to one other thing on equal charges. There was something I forgot. If you end up, some court reporters, and again, I get this from court reporters who have called me, charge different fees for different markets. For example, the Bend market or the Pendleton market or some market may be a lesser fee amount because they're not used to paying a higher fee than Portland. So, for example, if I notice a deposition in Portland, then everybody gets charged whatever the Portland fee is. But a court reporter from Portland to do a deposition in Bend may actually charge a lesser fee for the Bend person. Well, under this bill, they couldn't do that. Because you, Mr. Chair, if you noticed the deposition, would have to, once they got into the case, they would look at it and say, I got Portland attorneys, I got Bend attorneys. I am definitely going to be charging the Portland rate on this. So what you're doing is, in effect, precluding the small town attorney from getting the benefit of, in effect, the regional rates. The one court reporter who was not involved with Marinette called me when this bill was going through and said, what do I do in that situation? I said, well, depends on the interpretation.
Well, to some extent, the market might control it because you could hire a Bend court reporter at the Bend rate for being both sides of the deposition.
That is precisely the situation. If you don't like the fee somebody is charging, it's court reporting. You can hire a different court reporter.
Other questions for these witnesses?
Mr. Chair, may Mr. Olmark respond?
He may.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I did want to point out to you, Amerinet is not the only company across the country that's doing this. There's 9 or 10 of them out there, and there's a lot more serious abuses than, and I will give credit to Amerinet. There are local reporters in Oregon that do their work. Try to do as much as they can on this, but these other companies are abusing the situation considerably. As far as quickly the rates being charged different, and what is the problem? Statutorily and under the Orton Rules of Civil Procedure, a court reporter is deemed an officer of the court for the purpose of doing that deposition. That's how the transcript can get introduced into evidence and be used for impeachment or other purposes of a party. It's because it's deemed to be done by an officer of the court, and it has the reliability and the acceptance that it's accurate on there. To me, what we're doing here is preferred customer treatment, and I can't imagine what would happen in the state if we came in and said, well, gee, maybe the courts ought to give litigants who have a lot of litigation in our courts, maybe they ought to get cut rates for fees, trial fees, and filing fees and so forth, because they have a lot of litigation. And that, to me, is preferred treatment or preferred customer treatment. And that's what this is all about. We must maintain the appearance of propriety and objectivity. I've seen too many cases in courts where staff people have been accused and lawsuits filed against them because of the paranoia and the suspect and the distrust as it is, and we must maintain the trust of our courts. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay.
Any last comment?
Any other questions?
I have no questions, Mr. Chair. I'm ready to talk about another bill.
All right. Charging the P&T schedule.
I'm just looking at the word.
Get your shot. You're going to get your shot.
I just want my shot. I'm going to get your shot. Please.
For that.
Can we leave?
Well, I'm working on some clarification. Right, and if it's different, it's a sea change later on, 6 months or a year has gone by, it's still the same charge of the same fee schedule, it just changes the fee schedule. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Mr. Chair, if you are considering language different than what Representative Williams felt his interpretation was, I would suggest you have a conference with Representative Williams. His understanding of the bill is not Mr. Meyer's understanding of the bill.
Well, what I'm struggling with is on line 2, page 2, and because making equal charges all parties, I don't think reads as clearly as what you've explained. And what I was playing around with was saying charging the same fee schedule for to all parties. Pardon? But if you charge from the same fee schedule, because it isn't necessarily an equal charge. It's the same fee schedule you're talking about. It's the same.
Chair, the CSR rules talk about the same fee rate for the proceeding in the entire case and for transcript and copy charges. I think that
makes sense.
That's clearer, and then it allows a different fee for the original and a different fee for the copy.
Right, and then if 6 months go by and you charge 35 cents a mile rather than 33, it's still okay because you're using the same fee charge on that particular day.
So if you're going to change Section B of Section, Line 2 on Section 2, we would suggest you adopt the language that the Supreme Court has adopted.
Where is that?
On the CSR, that handout that I
have that in front of me.
Page handout, Section 6 at the bottom on the right, the left-hand column, disclose and provide to all parties.
All right, I like that language, and it provides the consistency then between the Supreme Court. All right, the chair's wish would be to adopt that change. We'll have to have a draft.
Okay.
Conceptually, I can't do that and not violate that. I think that'll answer one of the concerns. So I'll bring the bill back for the session for that.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, thank you, Justin.
Thank you, Chair.
We will now close the public hearing on House Bill 2731. And Senator Courtney would like us to go back to 2806 and to make some comments. Senator Courtney.
We all have to leave the committee for different reasons. And while I was outside, I went to a fist fight with one of my fellow Democrats. A motion was made to move this bill to public affairs. I just want to say that I've been on this committee since the beginning of the session. I asked to be on the committee. I didn't ask to be vice chair. I've been a good member. I can take losing. I lost on DNA. I lost on 722. I've always treated every member of the committee with respect. I asked that bill be put in this committee. I asked Gary Wilhelm to put 2806 in this committee. Let it be heard in this committee, publicly heard, up or down. And what I'm asking is that you reconsider the vote. Make it be publicly heard here. If the votes in there are not here to move it to committee out on the floor, at that time you choose to move it to another committee, then so be it. But since I personally asked as a member of this committee and as vice chair to bring it to this committee, in deference to that, you make the bill be publicly heard here, evaluated here, and then at least decide at that time whether to put it to public affairs or try to put it out on the floor. Now, I'm just being very simple, very straightforward about that. Had I been here, not out in the hall, that's exactly what I would have said. I think this is the best committee, maybe one of the best committees I've ever served on in 8 terms, individually and collectively. And I want us to evaluate 2806. I want us to decide. And if in the long run, I understand politics. I understand courtesies. I understand who's in control and who's not. And if it needs then to go to public affairs in order to get it out before, if that's what's called, so be it. Make the motion and do it. But to move it to public affairs without this committee publicly hearing 2806, bringing in front of us those for and against it, I'm asking you not to do that. That is, I'm asking you to do that. And I'm asking you to reconsider the four of you that voted to move it there, because that's day four, because there's three that would have voted no. So that's what I'm asking.
First of all, when the motion was made, it was not because you were out in the
hallway. I understand. Mr. I truly understand. So if you took that, I mean, that is not what I meant. I would never accuse you of that. I know you wouldn't. That's not the way you and I compete. We do it nose on nose, toes on toes. I understand that. It's good football. I understand it.
Okay. Good.
That's not in my tone. That is not in my voice. I'm telling you right now.
You want to hear the bill?
Yes, I want the committee to hear the bill. And I'll take the consequences. If then you say, Peter, the majority here, let's call it like it is, wants to go on public affairs. Peter, even if I don't like it, it's going there. So be it. I want this committee to hear the bill.
All right. Let me do this. I'll commit to you to have a conversation with the majority leader, and I'll voice your arguments strongly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's all I can ask.
I will do that.
I appreciate that.
All right. What's next?
Can you send a videotape of what just happened? So the
I'll ask you. You know, I like to play Peter's role. So. I'll bring out my khaki pants, buy a short sleeve blue shirt, and color my hair a little grayer, and I can provide the emotion. I know that. Let's do those two then. All right. We'll open public hearing on House Bill 2759. And who do we call?
I think it's
oh.
Hello, Father. Hello, Mr.
Okay, I've got a shorter one, so excuse me for a moment. We're not doing 1205 today. I'm going to instead do a public hearing in House Bill 3509 and invite Matt Marti forward to it.
Is that
35? Also, Jana Stindell from Stuff. Excuse me, and Brad Swank. We only have three with us. And committee, each of you should have in front of you a copy of the inventory of state receivables and a fact sheet that more or less summarizes that.
Yeah. I was very impressed with this report.
Well, thank you. That came out of, and I want to thank also Ann Twee for putting it together. It came out through the Senate Budget Committee, and the Oregon Collection Association did the collation on it. But we asked the question, what are your receivables and how do you collect them and those sorts of things, and they put a lot of time and effort into this. So I appreciate that. Matt.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Matt Marti, representing the Oregon Collectors Association today. The Oregon Collectors Association worked in conjunction, as the Chair just stated, with the Senate Interim Budget Committee in putting together a survey that would try to inventory all of these state receivables owed to state agencies. I'd like to thank Senator Bryant, the Chair of the Senate Interim Budget Committee, and all staff, including Ann Tweet, that helped to make this project possible. The survey was sent out to 119 divisions of state government and asked some fairly simple questions about the amount of total receivables owed to their state agency, how this increased over the last five fiscal years, the number of delinquent accounts, the dollar amount collected by fiscal year, the cost of collections, age of their accounts, a description of their collection program, and where the receivables had come from. Most all the agencies responded to the survey. There were a few that did not. We ended up with 52 divisions of state government and 84 collection programs with a collection program. Many of the surveys that came back to the Senate Interim Budget Committee were very incomplete and were all followed up with at least one phone call to help come up with more information. What we were able to come up with was the amount of receivables owed to state agencies for the fiscal year ending June 30th, 1997. The rest of the data was scarce at best. This was due to a number of reasons. State agencies told us that they didn't keep track of the information, or their computer didn't keep track of the information, but most of them said that they were, this was a good exercise and we're going to start keeping track of this stuff. What we found were 8 programs with a balance of over $1 million in receivables at this time that had no idea how much they'd collected in any given year. We also found that as of June 30th, 1997, there was over $1.8 billion in delinquent accounts owed the state government. This $1.8 billion was broken out into $500 million in general funds, about $1 billion in other funds, and around $350 million in miscellaneous and lottery funds. Between fiscal year 96 and 97, most state agencies couldn't give us the information for those two years, but the ones that could, we found that this figure grew by $200 million in that 1 year. Not all agencies could give us the age of the accounts, but of those that could, we found that 70% of it was over 90 days old. The survey failed to ask how much was written off in each year. We did find that the Judicial Department this current year is planning on moving to an inactive status, $100 million, and that also the Department of Transportation's weight mile program had written off $4 million in that year, and they only had about $10 million in receivables. There are many different techniques used by state agencies for collecting delinquent debts. Most people do use Department of Revenue. Department of Revenue has 2 programs that is available to state agencies. One is the restricted program, which is a tax offset only program, so that they create a list of tax refunds due to Oregonians and match that with their debtors and take a tax offset. Secretary of State did an audit report that showed that this only amounts to 1% of all collections due to the state, but it is a good resource for many collection programs and can be as high as 82% of a collection program's total collection. It's also a very cost-effective method. The unrestricted program with Department of Revenue is a program that is a total collections program. It was interesting here that most state agencies had no idea how much money they turned over to Department of Revenue in this category, and also they did not know how much was collected by Department of Revenue. It was very hard going through all this data to make any specific conclusions because of the lack of data, especially in the prior years, but there's clearly room to make some improvements. When you look at national studies and national trends, 22% of all delinquent debt is considered to be collectible. Now, this state debt here is older than most, and it's probably less than the 22% that is collectible, but I'm sure that there's a good portion of this that is collectible. House Bill 3509 originally, as introduced, set up a reporting requirement for all state agencies to report annually to the Legislative Fiscal Office the beginning balance of all receivables, new receivables added, the total collections in that year, the total amount of written-off debt, and their ending balance. And again, they'd report that to the Legislative Fiscal Office. Then the bill went on to say that if an agency was going to write off an account, that at that time the account would have to be turned over to a private collection agency so that they'd have an opportunity to collect on the money. The idea here is thinking that if the state agency was unable to collect the money, well, let's give somebody else a try, because collecting something for the state is always better than nothing. When talking with Secretary of State Phil Kiesling, he said that this was a good idea, except the only problem is that most state agencies don't write off a lot of debt. And he said that most state agencies, rather than writing the debt off, move it to an inactive status. So we tried to amend the bill to say, at the time of moving an account to an inactive status where the account would no longer be worked, that at that time a private collection agency would have a chance to work on that debt. The problem is that all state agencies define inactive status differently. So our original idea was to say that if you had a delinquent account in 6 months, you had no payment on that account within 6 months, that at that time you need to turn it over to the Department of Revenue or to a private collection agency. If you turned it over to the revenue would then also have 6 months to try and collect the debt. There was a lot of concern with that among state agencies, so we negotiated for over a month on the House side to try and come up with a compromise. What we were able to come up with, and we combined the 6 months together into 1 year. Department of Revenue felt that if everybody else had a year on their delinquent accounts, they'd like a year, and other state agencies felt that the 6 months, they may want it for 8 months and to turn it over to revenue for 4 months. So we went 1 year no matter where it was at, and to be to be determined by the state agency. We left the reporting aspect in the bill as it was originally introduced, and we created a list of exemptions. The first thing we said is that any account that is would be against the law to turn over to a private collection agency, that was a given, and we exempted that out. We also exempted out any debt that was secured by consensual security and interest in real or personal property, anything that was a court-ordered restitution or payment to the Department of Justice for crime victim assistance, anything that if a debt was currently in litigation, student loans owed by a student while still attending school, any debt owed to a state agency by a local, state, or federal government. We also exempted out if the debtor was hospitalized in the state hospital, that would be exempt. Things that would not be cost-effective to turn over to a private collection agency, and if the state agency would lose in federal funds, anything, if it wasn't against the law to turn it over, but they'd lose federal funds by turning the account over, we exempted those out. We also, because we were afraid that might not be all the exemptions needed, we also said that up to 35% of anything additional could be exempted out through rule by the Department of Administrative Services.
So in addition to all the exemptions, then there's a blanket exemption up to 35% if the agency adopts
Mr. Chair, that is correct, and that would be done through a rule process through DAS. We negotiated that. I thought we had an agreement. And then when we went to hearing in the House, there was some objection from DAS, and they felt the bill was now too specific, too much detail in the bill, and they were afraid that they wouldn't be able to comply with this if it were ever put in statute. So we do have some amendments here today, the Dash 6 and the Dash 7 amendments that were written at our request. And the first thing it does, it adds to the list of exemptions, people in prison. This was an oversight. We didn't want those accounts to have to be turned over. And then it also takes out the 35% additional discretion and says by rule, DAS can exempt anything they wish to for state agencies. Basically what this does is takes out the 35% and puts in 100% discretion. It does leave the reporting requirements in. We feel that if you're going to manage your receivables properly, you have to know what you have. And the reporting part of this bill, we feel, is very important.
Well, I think as a state legislature, we would like to know what agencies have as account receivable and how they collect them. And I mean, to me, you have to have that information.
The difference between the Dash A7 and the Dash A6 is that the Dash A6 also takes out a provision in the bill which is a vendor debtor offset study program. The Secretary of State's Audits Division found that there are many state agencies writing a check to one of their vendors while that same vendor was a debtor to another state agency. We felt that it would be a good idea for Department of Administrative Services to set up some type of study to see the cost and feasibility to put in a vendor debtor offset program. When we put that in the House, it came back with about $120,000 fiscal. And so the Dash A6 would delete that as well. The A6 and A7, we are in support of either one of those. It's kind of a policy choice between for you guys of whether or not the feasibility of doing a vendor debtor offset program is appropriate. That's where we stand at this point. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Yes.
The fiscal on that is $100,000, did you say?
That's what I've been told, yes.
Okay. Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Does that start the program at the beginning of the biennium?
That $100,000, Mr. Chair, Senator Brown, it doesn't set up the program. It is just to do the study to see if we should set up the program.
All right.
Questions for Matt? So you are in favor of the 6 and 7?
Either one of those. It would be a 1 or the other.
And again, the Dash A4 comes from Dash, correct?
Correct.
Which you oppose?
We do oppose that.
Thank you. And did you have another question? Janet.
Mr. Chair, member of the committee, I am Janet Tindall. I am the Assistant Administrator for the State Comptroller's Division at the Department of Administrative Services. We agree with a lot of the concerns that the committee has raised and also the Urban Collectors Association. As Matt stated, the agency found this exercise to be of use and found that they actually did indeed need to be collecting more of this information. And I have some prepared comments, but I think I'm going to maybe divert from those since you have them in front of you.
We do have them.
And with the $1.8 billion that was in the report, that is, for the most part, total agency accounts receivable. It reflects current debt, as Matt said. It also reflects items that are in bankruptcy, that are undergoing appeals, that could be in litigation. There could be a whole number of items and reasons why the agencies are not actively collecting on those accounts. The age of accounts is a concern that agencies don't necessarily track an age after the account it becomes worth the dated amount and it's delinquent. They track their accounts receivable based on county standards, which says when a debt becomes due, they start tracking it at that point. Some of the agencies, we will agree, are not doing that, and we want to work with them better. We certainly have no objection to providing a report to the legislative fiscal office and having them compile some information for the legislative body. Our concern is that if we get too specific too soon, that the agencies won't be able to do this. They'll feel compelled to either go in and expend money on updating their systems right away. We'd rather work with the agencies and gradually develop a report and improve upon that maybe year after year until it becomes something that's really of value to you and also to us currently at the statewide level. Other piece of this, which we did work with Matt said with them, and I really got kind of bogged down in the agency concerns and details of the whole bill. We kind of stepped back and started looking at what was the policy issues that were being addressed here, and that had to do with agency accountability and also increasing revenues that are due to the state and due to other individuals who we collect money for, like the federal government and child support payments such as that. So we wanted to try and come up with a way that we could address all the special concerns without getting into the infinite detail of exclude this program, don't exclude that program, we'll exclude part of this one but not that. And we wanted the agencies to come to the Department of Administrative Services with their reasons for needing to be excluded from turning debts over for private collection or why they weren't able to collect them themselves. And maybe as we gather more information from that, we can help them address those areas and make this process better in the future. So I guess what we're asking for is an opportunity to handle this through administrative processes, working with the agencies, working with the Urban Collectors Association. We've already got the audit report from the Secretary of State, and we have a committee that's been meeting now about 18 months that represents quite a few of the larger debt collection agencies, and we want to provide information that is meaningful, and we want to comply with the policy direction that we feel this bill is moving us towards, and we want to involve the private collection agencies, so we're working on a statewide contract now that will allow all agencies to use private collection agencies if they're allowed to by law. Now, our real opposition to this bill is the amount of detail that was included in it, and as far as the policy direction that was intended, we certainly support that, and that's why we ask your support of our Dash A form.
Questions? She did the Dash A4. Question. Thank you. Brad.
Chair Bryant, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Brad Slank. I'm with the State Court Administrator's Office. We're here because we've been following this bill since the House side. We expressed some technical concerns on the House side to the proponents of the bill, and they asked us if we would address those when the bill came over on the Senate side. And they are concerned with how we would manage this issue in relation to courts, and there are some separation of powers issues. So we have been working with both collectors and DOCS on amendments to to figure out how courts fit into this and to work it out in terms of our management and our branch of government. Because we've been trying to develop a system to get you this sort of information for the past 4 or 5 years, and it's something that we think you have a right to know, and we're working with both sides to try and figure out how we fit into each of them. We heard late last night, I heard it about 5:15, it may have been a little earlier than that, it may have been 4:15, that there was a drafting problem with the amendments that we had. We offered amendments to both sides to present our technical issues. Both sides were comfortable with our amendments, as far as I know. Legislative Counsel's office had some problems with the amendments because of the relating clause of the bill. And we've been working, I've been tied up today, but I've been working with Matt and Jim Marquis, and I haven't had a chance to talk to Janet yet, to try and resolve those drafting problems for the amendments to get our issues, our technical issues, into both of the sets of bills. So I guess what we're asking for is a little time to resolve those drafting issues in either concept that you're thinking of, in either direction, and what we're looking for is an appropriate place to put our concept so that the courts sort of go along with whatever direction we're heading.
The chair's direction is to go to the dash 6 or 7, and I think the committee would be heading in that direction. If you could do that promptly, and also we need the new fiscal report, because hopefully if there's a sign of picking up some revenue, then you don't have to send it on the ways we need.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, if I may, we have talked to the Judicial Department, and we do agree with their amendments and their separation of powers issues, but we have found another vehicle in Senate Bill 65, and have talked to the proponents of Senate Bill 65, and they would be happy to put the Judicial Department's concerns into that bill, and if the committee so chooses, that would be our preference.
Sure. Thank you. I need to get to the other bill, but Jana, you mentioned the bill being too specific. In Section 2, lines 17 through 26, which just talked about beginning balances and those sorts of things, total collections, to me those are so general. I mean, whatever you do, those basics would have to be there, and whatever rules adopted, they have to be there. So by putting them in the bill, I think that's essential, because you can end up with those same things when you draft your rules.
Mr. Chair, we agree with that. Our biggest concern actually is the age of accounts and the agency's inability to track those at 30, 60, 90 kind of tenure, and especially with the language that's in here of them having to track their liquidated amount and delinquent. That is different than what we require them on an accounting basis to track that, so that would add additional tracking requirements either on a manual basis or some automated change.
And they might be able, with the generous exemption requirements, to do the tracking on 65% of them or something. Anyway, we'll need to look for those amendments or send it to another bill, as was suggested, or get some fiscal, so we'll bring it back.
Mr. Chair, if I may ask one more thing.
Yeah.
If we go back to the original bill, then the fiscal impact that was filed with the same gross version will stand.
Right, but what it doesn't include is potential revenue that could be generated.
And, Mr. Chair, also, with our amendment, we do take out in the bill as it's written now, people have to apply to Department of Administrative Services, and I believe in the fiscal, they have part of an FTE in there for people to sign off on each account, and we fixed that problem in our amendment so that Department of Administrative Services would just have to write the rules and not sign off on all the accounts.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And
Mr. Chairman, this has been asked, but Jenna, have you folks had a chance to go through this book?
Yes, sir.
Do you agree with this?
Senator Bryant, Senator Tarnum, yes, we have gone through it.
Do you agree with this book?
Senator Bryant, Representative Senator Tarnum, I would have to say in the feedback I've gotten from agencies, they feel that there was a certain bias in putting that information together. We tried to work with Ann during the survey process to get more specific information on what exactly was asked. And in fact, there was a contractor, Mr. Terry Drake, I believe, who was going to be compiling that information, and we had set up an appointment with him to meet with, I don't know, it's like 20 agencies or so, and he failed to be able to attend that meeting. So we answered it, and we tried to answer it as consistently as we could, but recognizing that each agency has unique problems and unique reporting requirements.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, in terms.
This thing scares me. If we have that much money over the state of Oregon out there, then we better be doing something to get it back.
We certainly need to do a better job than we have in the past.
Absolutely.
And we need to keep the records better so that we have our fingertips.
If you don't mind, just for the record, too, the problem I think that we were looking at when we sent the survey out, which is actually, I think, an appendix in that spiral bound book that you have, the actual survey that we sent out to all the agencies. I think the kind of budget committee was thinking that at the end of the survey, that they would be introducing legislation, I think, to actually try to either collect it or to try to affect the process in some regard. But what the process really showed is that we didn't even know how to ask the question. We didn't even know what we needed to ask the agency to be able to obtain the information. And then when we kind of watered down or kind of nailed down what the questions were, we then found out that it was very difficult for all agencies to answer them. It's certainly impossible for all of them to answer them in the same regard. And so we did kind of put a halt, I think, to what the committee initially wanted to do in that process, recognizing that we had to come up with some way to even ask the questions, which I think is what the bill before you is trying to propose.
Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Closed public hearing, and now open public hearing on two bills, HB 2760, HB 2759. They're related, and I invite David Niebel and Judge Welch to come forward. The good news is by being the last on the agenda today, four of the witnesses have left and said we no longer oppose the bill. No, they are neutral. And one of them said yes. One of them said I no longer oppose. So, and Jennifer Wright, why don't we have you come up because you signed up on both bills too.
Mr. Chair, well, yes. Folks are coming up. I remember that Judge Welch was down here during the 97th session, and the Senate bill she got to hear was Senate Bill 44.
Oh, I remember Senate Bill 44.
Testimony, so she has a fairly skewed perspective at this point of how we operate.
I will never forget the public testimony.
Thank you.
Well, David, you probably want to go first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm David Niebel with the Oregon Law Center, and I'm here today in support of both House Bill 2759 and 2760. I'm also here to speak in favor of the amendments that you have, the A2 amendments to 2759 and the A4 amendments to 2760. These bills, as you said, are related. They come out of a process that began over a year ago among advocates for people with disabilities and senior citizens. They're concerned about two things about protective proceedings generally. One is the practice of professional fiduciaries in communities, and the other is just the general due process that people who are faced with these kinds of proceedings are afforded. The professional fiduciaries bill is House Bill 2759. And that basically does two things. First, it would strengthen the conflict of interest provisions that are actually applicable to all fiduciaries, not just professional fiduciaries. And the second thing it would do is it would require certain disclosures from professional fiduciaries in petitions, in protective proceedings, and these disclosures are designed to inform the court and others interested in the person's welfare and the person, him or herself, about who this person is, who is taking charge of the decision-making for the person whose rights are being circumscribed, I guess. Professional fiduciaries, just as background, are folks in the community who act as guardians or conservators, mainly in cases for whom there's no one else available to do that. They generally do a fine job. There is actually a professional association, and I think we'll probably hear from one of their members today, that tries to enforce or encourage its members and others who do this trade to act in an ethical and good business-like manner. There are some problems, though, that have arisen with conflicts of interest and with fees being charged that seem to be a little inappropriate that we thought need to be addressed. So this bill, House Bill 2759, has two principal sections. The first is a rewrite of the conflict of interest provisions that are applicable to fiduciaries in general. That's in Section 2. It takes the approach of requiring disclosures to the court to in cases in which there may be a conflict of interest, and it gives the court continuing oversight to assess whether the fiduciary is actually acting in the client's best interest or whether the fact that they have this potential conflict of interest may be swaying their decision making. So this is a disclosure bill that gives the court oversight authority. The other principal part of this bill requires disclosure of certain information about business practices of the professional fiduciary, background of the professional fiduciary in the petition, so that people can assess who this person is, whether they're really qualified to act as the decision maker for a protected person. It also requires criminal records checks to be provided to the court. And so that's basically what that does. The amendments, the Dash 2 amendments, A2 amendments, were designed to allay some of the concerns of the professional fiduciaries who are public guardians and public conservators, and also to deal with various technical matters about criminal records checks. And actually, after we got the A2 amendments today, and we had a conference out in the hall among interested parties, and I think, except for one issue, everyone is in agreement. All the interested parties are in agreement about the Dash A2 amendments. We do have some conceptual amendments to those. I'm afraid, and I understand that you can't adopt conceptual amendments, so I'm afraid this is going to have to go back to Legislative Council. But I can describe the conceptual amendments if you'd like, and what they basically involve is giving the State Court Administrator's Office or relying on the State Court Administrator's Office to make rules preserving the confidentiality of the criminal records checks that are provided to the court. The professional fiduciaries who are providing these records to the court don't want these records to be just open to anybody who's looking through the files. The amendment, the A2 amendment as drafted, said that the court could seal these. Judge Welsh brought up the specter of having huge file folders full of the sealed records for no particular purpose, and so she wanted the opportunity to be able to destroy these. And so we're going to tweak the language to put that in to make sure that these amendments, these records were confidential, and to allow the administrator to make rules about how they would be disposed of. So I think everyone is on board on this bill, and I'd be happy to try to answer any questions that the committee may have.
Judge, do you want to speak first?
Well, I don't have a great deal to say. Good afternoon. I'm Judge Elizabeth Welch. I'm the Chief Family Court Judge in Portland and therefore also the probate judge. And this is a bill that I think is the product of some communication between our court and Mr. Neeble's organization. And the idea behind this disclosure came from work that's being done collaboratively by the probate judge in Clackamas, the probate judge in Washington, and myself. Well, we are as one on many things, and this is one of the things that we want to do. This is a very significant issue and problem for us. And I don't know if you want to hear about sort of what the underlying issue is or not. If you're comfortable with this, you don't have questions. You're very comfortable with this? Then I don't really want to say anything other than that it's a good bill.
Mr. Vice Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jennifer Wright. I'm here on behalf of the other law section of the Oregon State Bar, and we support this bill.
Thank you. Now, is that all the witnesses? Okay, any questions?
I'm just asking counsel.
Yes,
Jennifer, I did get an answer to your other question on that other bill, and it has to be equal for all. So,
thank you, Senator.
Thank you very, very much. Holly, you want to hear from Holly? Holly, you want to say anything?
I'm not going to say anything.
Yes. Shut the door. They're
open right there. They're open at the same time.
They're open at the same time. Okay. Why don't you just pull up the chair?
Mr. Chair, I think it's only fair after all the years that Holly answered questions for us that we'd be able to ask her questions for change.
Chair, members of the committee, turnarounds, fair play. My name is Holly Robinson. For the record, I'm here on behalf of Senior and Disabled Services Division, and I'm here primarily to talk about a survey that we did during the last half of 1998 regarding adult guardianships in Oregon. One of the things that we discovered in this arena is that there really is no data to talk about the problems that exist. And it was really our survey process that brought a lot of information to light and collected it in one place. For example, as a result of the survey process, I can tell you that the visitor fees in Oregon range from $50 to $300, depending on the court that you're in. But prior to our doing the survey, that information was not available. We surveyed 225 files in 12 counties. Because of the way that the data is kept in the OGIN system, the Oregon Judicial Information System, we're hoping to have some continuing conversations with them about an increased ability to pull out probate cases, which does now currently exist. So even though we looked at 225 cases, I can't tell you what percentage, nor can they, for that matter, tell you what percentage of adult guardianship files that represents in Oregon. I think this was a very good step in terms of keeping, beginning to create a database or better information about these kinds of cases and what is going on in them. They have historically not been a high priority, but because of the numbers of individuals who are aging and the numbers of individuals who are in need of guardianship services, and I think because of the abuses that we've all seen, the ability to start maintaining better data is incumbent on all of us. So with that, I recommend this reading to you, and I'll be happy to answer your questions.
Any questions? Thank you very much.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Thank you, ma'am.
But currently, House Bill 27 59 needs some additional work, and so my question would be this, another amendment to 25.760. Are the amendments copacetic and is all involved?
Mr. Chair, Senator Brown, there are amendments to 2760. I don't think you've heard a description of what 2760 does exactly yet, but there are going to have to be some conceptual amendments to 2760 also. But with those conceptual amendments, I think the judges who are here today who had previously had concerns and others, I think, are satisfied that this bill is a workable product. And I can just be very brief in describing what 2760 is. For the record, again, I'm David Niebel with the Oregon Law Center. House Bill 2760 started out as a major due process revision of the guardianship statute that would have required hearings in more cases, provided court-appointed counsel in cases where the respondent requested it, and beefed up the court visitor system that we have now, making the court visitor a full-time employee with responsibility for oversight of guardianship and conservation files. In light of the fiscal impact that would be involved with that, all the fiscally sensitive parts of this were cut out in the House, and what we're left with in the printed bill is a good bill, a worthwhile bill, but one that basically involves the notice that a respondent gets when he or she receives a petition to establish a guardianship or a conservatorship over them. This notice is written in very clear language tells them what their options are when they get this if they don't agree with the provisions that are proposed. It also requires, under certain circumstances, that the notice of a proceeding be given to the Long-Term Care Ombudsman's Office and to the Oregon, the Oregon Advocacy Center that represents people with disabilities. So that's what the bill amounts to now, and there is one small amendment to that bill that is required. The dash four amendments that I think Judge Welch is principally interested in create a pilot project in Multnomah County along the lines of the original bill.
And the funding of that?
And the funding of that, the original bill has been, there's an amendment that apparently takes care of the fiscal impact on the state, which is, you'll find on page 3 of the amendments, dash A4 amendments, line 21, it says that a visitor may be an employee of the court, so it's not requiring the court to employ a person as its own employee, the visitor as its own employee. The provisions for court-appointed counsel are made discretionary with the court, so that takes out that part of the fiscal impact. And I think that the program doesn't start until July 1st next year. And I think that the Multnomah County Circuit Court is looking for grants as upfront fee to start this upfront. And the program is designed to be, to a certain extent, self-sustaining after a while because fees are taken out of the estate upon closure. So I think that it is fiscally, this bill is fiscally neutral at this time with the dash A4 amendments. And with that, I will turn it over to Judge Ross.
And probably what we need to do is adopt the dash 4, send it down to legislative fiscal just so they could have a look at it before we send it out.
And Mr. Chair, I would suggest before you adopt the A4, you send it back to LC for these conceptual amendments.
Judge Welch.
Again, Judge Welch from Multnomah County Circuit Court. We're very excited about this pilot project and something we very much want to do. And if I may say this and without fear of being injured, it is borrowed from the California courts do this, and they have for many years. And we know that the programs are self-sustaining, that the funds generated for the visitors. Basically, that's what we're talking about here. When there's a guardianship now, we immediately appoint one of our visitors to go out and check out the situation. And in Portland, I'm almost positive it's 225, so we're kind of in the middle of Holly's range. Those fees will pay for the program. But you need to pay somebody's salary until you collect them. And so we are taking on the responsibility, and we're happy to do that, to find our own seed money to get this program going. In California, when they started it, I think it was a one-time shot from their legislature that they got, you know, first year or two paid for, and then they were on their own. And this has worked, and it's been going for many years. And what it's going to allow us to do is not only to have visitors in that initial stage of guardianship, but also to have what we expect to be an employee or employees who, on the anniversary of guardianship, if there's any reason to be of concern about whether this person's getting adequate care, if the guardian report that comes in is troublesome in any way, if any of the counties that we're getting in a conservatorship bother us, then we will have someone that we will send out to look to investigate what is going on. These proceedings are so scary in terms of lack of oversight, because there are people out there that are managing other people's money and managing other people's lives, and their only potential protector is the court. It's a very odd role that we have, but we've got to have that. We either do it or we don't do it. And right now, I think in most of the country and in most of the state, it isn't being done. That oversight is not occurring. and we are very concerned about the implications of that, particularly as the population ages and the numbers of people we're talking about is exploding, that we make sure that those folks who we are allowing someone else to completely control are getting what they have a right to get to, and that we would all want and expect them to have. So that's what we, why we're anxious to do this. We will probably use this individual, if this all comes together the way we want to, also occasionally in straight probate matters, when they're missing assets, when someone reports that somebody moved all the furniture out of Granny's house and nobody knows where it is, that we have some way to find out what happened. We, in conservatorship, we freeze, we say to somebody, okay, you settle this lawsuit, you put the money for kiddo in a bank account, in a restricted account. Nobody can have access to that restricted account except with the court's permission. But all the banks now, you know, have coalesced, and there aren't very many of them left, and it's get very hard to keep track of these restricted accounts. And we will have, this will, again, give us the wherewithal to actually literally find out, are those accounts still intact? Are they, are those assets being preserved as the order requires? So you can see why we're kind of enthusiastic about this, and we're willing to sort of to front the whole thing and see how it goes. And we have the support of the judges from Marion County and Washington County who are here and had to leave. Their concern is that they don't have the confidence that we do that it will be self-sustaining, so they want us to do it first. And then if we fail, then they'll know they were right, and if we succeed, then they'll do it too.
How much do you anticipate the program cost? And the reason I ask that is I can think of at least two special projects that have been funded in Deschutes County, and I want to make sure that all the counties get their fair share of special projects this session.
So I can't give you an exact number. We haven't really developed that, but Doug Blaze is here, our Chief Court Administrator from Multnomah County, is here to answer any more questions you have about how this thing's all to be put together. He and I were chatting a few minutes ago, and my recollection is that we generate about $80,000 a year in visitor fees. They don't come to the court, they go direct to the visitor from the paying person. And we believe that $80,000 will be more than adequate to pay the salary for and overhead for a full-time, very highly qualified person. And so, I mean, I don't want to be held to that number, but I think that's approximately what we're looking at. And we think we can run a program with that.
Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions?
Yes.
Did you want to testify?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Jennifer Wright for the Elder Law Section of the Oregon State Bar, and we support the bill and the Dash 4 amendments. That's it.
Thank you.
My understanding is the Dash 4 needs some additional amendments.
Right.
Okay.
Well, so we'll bring it back. Any other person like Tessa?
I'd say one thing that I promised I would say for the record.
You may.
I have promised the public guardian in Multnomah County that who is worried about fiscal impact if we have a lot more hearings, that if there is a fiscal impact for their office, that I will personally see to it that the Board of County Commissioners is informed of that, and I will support them in attempting to obtain adequate resources to staff the any effects from the increase in business that this program might generate. Thank you.
Thank you.
Minor clarification, I referred to the judges referred to $80,000. I assume you were talking about $80,000 per year.
Yes.
From Rushdale for a revision of the
biennial. Right, except you, this would begin the second year of the biennial.
Second year.
Right.
So that's all we would need for the
Quit looking at me that way. Thank you for your testimony. With that, we'll conclude the public hearing. We'll bring this back to work session later. Our committee, thank you for your arduous work in the 3.5 hours. And tomorrow will be a fairly short day for us. And we won't work on Monday.
Put that right in.
Yeah,
I'll see you later.
Thank you.